are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, November 27th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America. Downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, White House lawyers told Trump of the whistleblower and that the whistleblower blew his cover before he unfroze the Ukraine aid. Meanwhile, as the Judiciary Committee announces its hearings will take place next week, newly released testimony states that two OMB officials resigned over the OMB machinations to hold up the Ukrainian aid. Meanwhile, over at the Supreme Court, Brett Kavanaugh signals that the Supreme Court is primed to destroy the regulatory state and stop just about anything a Democratic president would want to do. Indiana, meanwhile, quashed a report on an Amazon worker's death in pursuit of HQ2. Pete Buttigieg's pack for Democrats turns out to be a front for his own candidacy. And look, Ma, no calls. AOC's fundraising tops all Democrats in the House. Evictions, meanwhile, are plunging in New York City in the wake of the new rent control law.
Hell yeah, in your face, landlords.
Boom. Airline catering workers plan labor actions this holiday. And ICE creates a fake university to lure students who have overstayed their visas and deport them. And lastly, make no mistake, the assault on Medicare for All is an assault on the left-wing candidates in the Democratic primary. All this and more on today's program. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. I've just got to fix my seat here. It is the day before Thanksgiving. Welcome. We will get to calls earlier than normal today. We'll make it a freebie Tuesday or Wednesday. We'll make it a freebie Tuesday, which, of course, for people who've been around, know that means it's Wednesday. And
this is all coded.
It's completely impromptu. We're all headed off for Thanksgiving. Which, of course, means that Michael already left and is not here. And we will be back. We will have a new show for you on Friday. Really fascinating a talk I had with Martha Jones, who is a professor who did wrote a book about birthright citizenship. And essentially, and you're going to hear more about this as time goes on. And it came up the other day with Perrine. So the other day with Alex Perrine had a piece that was fantastic about Reconstruction. And this book also is in part about Reconstruction. The fact is that we live in an America that was essentially, for all intents and purposes, founded during Reconstruction. Many of the things that we consider sort of like stalwarts of American society, and frankly, from a legal perspective, the overwhelming, not majority, but plurality of our Supreme Court cases deal with the 14th Amendment, which was passed during Reconstruction. and birthright citizenship was passed during during Reconstruction as a way of making sure that that basically Southern states didn't have an ability to deport slaves or former slaves at that point. And this book is about the development of those theories that took place actually before the Civil War. So interesting stuff. You'll enjoy that on Friday. Today we will do a double show. There will be no show tomorrow. And let's just start this off a little bit of house cleaning, I guess. But we have something rather exciting. Shoot, you know, this is this iPad work? Oh, it is. Okay, it's worked. I don't know what happened with that thing, but this is pretty exciting for us. Thank you very much. We got something in the mail today, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm going to do an unboxing. I'm just going to hide the address. As you can see, it is from YouTube. It is, as you know, we have a YouTube channel. Some of you are watching it right now. And when you get to be when you surpass the 100,000 subscriber milestone, they send you something 2.5 years after you did that. In fact, I think it was it must have been sometime in mid 2017 that we passed 100,000. But of course, if you're like me and you get your emails late, when they send you the redemption code, then you it takes you 2 years to respond. So that's why when you want a membership to the program and you email and it's taking a long time, just understand it's not just you. So this is it. Not that fancy, but it is squishy.
Ooh,
I'm sorry, that's not
it's
it.
Functional.
Yeah, that's not it. Here is the letter. Okay. Oh, congratulations on your. This is a. Was packaged in great care by Rick. All right, that's pretty
good. Shout out, Rick.
YouTube, you've done something very few YouTube creators accomplish. You had an astonishing 100,000 people subscribe to your channel. We know the numbers on YouTube can get really big, but you achieved the milestone with hard work, perseverance, probably a healthy sense of humor, too. You've accomplished can't be taken away from you, and we'd like to recognize you with the hardware, the Silver Creator Award. You don't know your rewards. You do it because you have a drive to and congratulations.
Apathetic steamrolling.
Yeah, apathetic steamrolling. And also, Susan Wojcicki, I can't pronounce her last name.
She met with Ruben, I think.
Yeah. Oh, she meet with Dave Ruben?
I think she did.
She didn't meet with us. But here it is, ladies and gentlemen. Well, this is kind of fancy. Look at that. There it is, ladies and gentlemen.
Wow.
Damn.
A little bit late. We are actually now at over 700,000 subscribers.
So we'll be getting six more of those.
Supposedly, but I know I think they don't give you anything until you get to a million, I think. But this gives me an opportunity to thank all of you, not just those of you who watch on YouTube, but all of you who watch on YouTube or listen to the live show or listen to the podcast. It is the support that you have given me and given the show and given everybody who works on this program for years has been really stunning to me. And, you know, I'm not particularly good at showing appreciation on a regular basis. I think some other hosts do that better than I do, but I want you to know that I do feel that for you and know that I have a tremendous opportunity that you've given me and I take it very seriously and I feel a big responsibility to you guys. You know, I last night ran into a viewer at the show. And then I was on, Twitter, you know, setting people like Ronald Reagan straight about their misplaced faith in the wrong apples for a cobbler. And all of that is a function of this program. And so I thank all of you so much and appreciate your support. It is almost 2 years to the day that Mike Cernovich tried to not just get me fired from MSNBC, but destroy this show. He sent a bunch of fake emails to all our sponsors. And that's really when I got was the one time I was worried about the whole thing, was that we were going to lose a big chunk of our revenue that supports this show. And in part, it was Maren and Brendan from WTF who defended this show in a big way by basically saying to advertisers, if you dump Sam's show, then you're going to be dumped from our show. But it was also just the tremendous amount of support that we got from you guys. And it was really, it was really moving to me. And so, thank you. Thank you so much. And, we will continue to do, the work that we do here and with you in mind and our responsibility to you. So thank you so much. Good night. And that is the show. That's why we did it for free today. So
sweet.
Yes. Well, it's nice. All right. Well, let's get into, let's do just this clip, folks. Let's play the clip and let's see if you can come up with what is a little bit problematic about Donald Trump's proclamations here. Now, to be fair, he's surrounded by women. So he's probably a little bit like he's got a little bit of the heebie-jeebies, maybe. And they're celebrating.
We don't know how many of them have blood coming out of their wherever.
That's true. It could be. It could be happening with all of them. He is celebrating the 100-year anniversary of women getting the right to vote in this country. And, here he is.
And they have. They've been working on this for years and years, and I'm curious why wasn't it done a long time ago? And also, I guess the answer to that is because now I'm president. We get things done. We get a lot of things done that nobody else got done. But maybe you could say a few words. You'll start a revolution.
Oh, I'll be happy.
Yeah. Well, one of the reasons I feel like they probably did not get the 100-year anniversary to mark and celebrate the 100-year anniversary of women's suffrage.
Obama's misogyny?
It could have been. But then, why didn't George W. Bush get it done back then, too? I suspect it is because you usually, to celebrate 100 years anniversary of anything, you generally need to wait 100 years. So, I guess theoretically it could have been done earlier in the year, unless you want to time it when it actually happened during the course of the year. Or maybe he's saying, women should have had the vote 50 years before that.
Yeah. Woodrow Wilson was president for 7 years at that point. Sitting on his ass.
A lot of people are talking about women's rights to vote these days. It's coming back.
We wouldn't have gotten involved in World War One had we done it sooner, is all I'm saying. Sorry.
His heart was in the right place. This clip is very whimsical.
Yes, it's right. Can you just imagine, you're sitting there in that Oval Office and you're celebrating this and he says something that's stupid and you still have to just be like, yeah. Man. Folks, support for today's show comes from my favorite conversation starters that I have on my desk right now. Mova Globes. I've got two of them. Mova Globes turn all on their own. You can use it with a bass or in any setting or without a bass in any setting, in any type of light situation. They have hidden magnets, I guess, that help it turn. It's pretty nuts. I wonder what happens if I do. Look at that. I think they're making each other turn. Oh, my God. That's so cool. They have over 40 different designs, including major works of art, world maps, views of the globe from outer space, views of other planets. In outer space, I've mentioned this before, but I feel obligated to say that Saul's favorite is Uranus. Of course, he's my son.
Do you know there's bigger ones? than...
They have bigger than these?
There's 4.5 and 6 inch.
Oh, I had no idea.
I think, is that 4.5 or is that 6?
Is this one the 4?
I think so. I don't know.
4.5.
This one looks cool too, though.
Yeah, that one is super cool. That is one of the antique terrestrial globes. And they have a couple of these. I think that one, I don't know what year that one's from, but they have some
1790.
With 4.5. Oh, so they have bigger ones. Oh, cool. But they have globes that have like that are antique, and so they don't show, let's say, Antarctica because it didn't exist, or they have routes that were taken by Cook as he traveled the world, or they have one of Mars.
Some are available in 8.5.
What?
Some are available in 8.5 inches.
Oh, folks, check it out. And these make for great gifts. And sometimes what happens is you intercept them as gifts and you don't end up giving them as gifts because you want them on your own desk while you're doing your podcast. But they're just in time for the holiday season. Our listeners can get 15% off when you visit movaglobes.com/majority and use the code majority. This is their biggest deal of the year, and it's only valid for a limited time. Usually it's 10% off, right? This is 15% off. So hurry over, MOVA, movaglobes.com/majority. Use the code majority and get 15% off of your purchase. Check it out, folks. Makes for a great gift. Great gift. Kids, adults, all of it.
Globalists.
Globalists, even better. All right. First thing, this is the most important thing that I have to tell you today. We have talked about this in the past. It's come up over the past year or two. We may not have paid as much attention to it then as we would have because it was unclear where essentially the fifth vote on the court was on this. But a year ago... A little more than a year ago, a year and a half ago, there was a case in the Supreme Court, Gundy versus the United States. And it was a case essentially asking whether federal law delegates too much authority to the Justice Department to determine whether sex offenders need to register with the government. Here's how our government functions. When Congress passes a law, whether it's one that deals with just, you know, let's say the EPA, for instance. When Congress passes a law like the Clean Water Act, Congress could say, you need to, the EPA needs to regulate the following 1,000 chemicals that cannot be in water supplies and have to be at a certain percentage of the water to be deemed safe. Now, one, the problem with that, I think, is self-evident. Like Congress would have to go through. That would be a very like sort of tedious law for Congress to spend its time writing. The other is that 6 months later, you may find a half a dozen other chemicals that are dangerous. So instead, what Congress does is say, we empower the EPA to keep our waters safe. And the way that they determine this is if they find anything that causes health concerns above a reasonable limit or inconsistent with the existing, they set some parameters. This is called delegation. And for about, I think it was a year or so in the 1930s, the court decided or was following a doctrine of non-delegation. That Congress did not have the ability to delegate this authority to the executive branch in the form of these executive agencies. Now, it's a bizarre concept. When you consider particularly that the Supreme Court seems to think that the presidency is incredibly powerful, like almost all powerful. But put that aside for a moment. We're talking about 85 years of settled administrative law in this country. I mean, really, in some respects, constitutional law. So last June, there was this case, Gundy versus the United States. All four Republican colleagues, or I should say justices, who were on the court at that time. It was only four because Kavanaugh did not participate in the Gundy case because he was not a member of the Supreme Court at the time. They all basically agreed that they wanted to limit Congress's ability to delegate this authority to an agency to figure out, to make out the details. And on Monday of this week, and we should link Ian Millhiser's piece at Vox.com because his piece is really good on this. Scott Lemieux has a great piece at the American Prospect on the day one agenda, talking about the chances that maybe the court could destroy all of the ability for the day one agenda. So on Monday, the Supreme Court announced it would not hear another case, Paul v. United States, which was almost identical to Gundy. However, Kavanaugh released an opinion explaining why he thought the court should not hear it. And his opinion praises Gorsuch's effort in writing the dissent in Gundy. And according to Ian Millhiser, Kavanaugh's Paul opinion suggests he would restrict federal power even more than Gorsuch would. If you know anybody who follows this stuff, their hair is on fire right now. Because the only reason why Millhiser suspects they didn't take this case and promote this principle of non-delegation was because the Supreme Court would have been embarrassed to have two cases within 18 months where they reversed themselves by 180 degrees simply because another Republican was appointed to the court.
Pace yourself.
Exactly. So they're going to wait. And he uses the example of the Clean Air Act. He writes, Clean Air Act provides that certain power plants must use, quote, the best system of emission reduction that currently exists, while also taking into account factors such as cost. Congress also tasked the EPA with studying what technology is available to reduce emissions with creating binding regulations instructing energy companies on which systems they must use to reduce emissions. As the technology evolves, the EPA may update its regulation so that power plants in 2019 use the best system of emission reduction that exists in 2019 and not the one that existed in the 1970s when the Clean Air Act was passed. He writes that non-delegation is the idea that the Constitution imposes limits, potentially very strict limits, on Congress's power to give regulatory authority to federal agencies. This also, I believe, would strike down things like this Michigan Independent Council. Now, it may be different because it's an independent committee to do redistricting. Now, it may be different because that's considered state authority, but if it's federal elections, I'm not sure, frankly. It's basically saying that the legislature cannot delegate any authority to do anything practically that they won't do themselves. And of course, it would be physically impossible to do this. So, under current law, quote, a statutory delegation is constitutional as long as Congress lays down by legislative act an intelligible principle to which the person or body authorized to exercise the delegated authority is directed to conform. So in other words, it has to explain with sufficient clarity what the agency is supposed to accomplish with its power, right? It's results based. Keep the water safe. Make sure the newest technology is employed to keep the air safe and clean. Well, Gorsuch wrote that the current law risks, now remember, this has been going on for 85 years. The current law risks giving agencies, quote, unbounded policy choices. He explains what the new limits he would impose on federal agencies, and what he explains, according to Millhiser, and I would I have no reason to doubt, is vague and hard to find any clear legal rule in what he discussed. But Gorsuch writes that a federal law permitting agencies to regulate must be, quote, sufficiently definite and precise to enable Congress, the courts, and the public to ascertain whether Congress's guidance has been followed. Now, here's the bottom line. The public, how would we measure that the public has, how would the public determine whether the federal law is sufficiently definite and precise so that it can be ascertained by the public? Like what vehicle would we use to determine the public has decided this? And what vehicle would we use that Congress has decided this? It would be like, do they need to pass another law on top of the law they just passed? Like, when Congress passes the law, they do so, and presumably they know what they're doing. Now, there are times where Congress passes laws and it has unintended effects, or the way they drafted it was incorrect, and they go back and they fix it. So really what it does is it basically allows the courts to determine whether it was sufficiently definite and precise, as opposed to now simply deferring to the ability of agencies to make this determination. And Congress always has the authority to go back and change it if they feel like these agencies have overstepped the bounds. Now, agencies can't go completely out of control because the courts still remain there as a way of, but it's just a question of parameters. So Millhiser writes, what does it mean for a statute to be sufficiently definite and precise, that people can ascertain whether Congress's guidance has been followed? Nobody has an idea, but as a practical matter, the answer to this question will be decided by the Supreme Court's Republican majority whenever it's confronted with an agency regulation. It would essentially give Republican-controlled Supreme Court, which we will have as it stands now, for at least a decade or, you know, more. Clarence Thomas is the oldest justice on the right, and he's in his, I think, 70s or early 70s, maybe, or late 60s. And
unless we pack it or term limit them.
I guess that's right. I mean, it's, if you have a Democratic Senate and a Democratic House that is willing to do that, and a president who's willing to do that. Now, the only president that has said that they would do something like that so far, I think is actually Warren. But be that as it may,
the only president
or the only presidential candidate.
I was going to say, the only president, FDR, he was threatening to pack the courts constantly, and it worked.
Well, yes, and they also instituted a pension system that also helped. But be that as it may, that's right. Short of something that's never happened before in the history of the country, or an untimely death, we're looking at this for the next two decades. Apparently, Alito wrote in that Gundy opinion, if a majority of this court were willing to reconsider the approach that we have taken for the past 84 years, I would support that effort. So Gorsuch and Alito, Roberts and Thomas both voted with Gorsuch. So that's at least four existing votes to revive the non-delegation doctrine. This, of course, favors Republicans significantly. One is because Democrats tend to support robust regulation. Republicans do not. Second reason, the Supreme Court is controlled by the Republicans. Now, in practice, what this means is that they will... think about what happened with the Section 5 of the Voting Rights Act. It was reauthorized by a Republican-controlled Senate, I think it was, in 2007, and the Democratically-controlled House. The whole Voting Rights Act was. Section 5 says that, or said, that like 14 states, more or less, needed to get pre-clearance from the Department of Justice before they made any changes to their voting rights or their voting, their voting rights or their voting system or their election system, whatever it is, anything to deal with voting needed to be first approved by the Department of Justice because of a history of racial discrimination in those states, including two counties in New York. So it's not just southern states. The Supreme Court basically said, the only reason why this was reauthorized was because Senate felt intimidated. Didn't want to be seen as racist. So we are going to strike this down because the formula is not right. We do believe the concept of preclearance is okay. We just don't think this formula is fair. So we will send it back to Congress to come up with a new formula. That was 5 or 6 years ago. And nothing has happened with the Voting Rights Act. Right? So imagine what happens if the Supreme Court says the Clean Air Act, no. The Clean Water Act, forget it. In fact, anything the EPA has done needs to go back to Congress and they need to give more specific regulations. Oh, banking regulations? No. The SEC has taken too much liberty here. It needs to go back to Congress, and they need to redo it. FDA regulations. I mean, you get where this is going, right? All of these things will simply languish.
Like, what's the alleged point of that? Like, what is their justification?
The Constitution does not give...
That is so annoying.
It is super annoying. I would say it's even worse than annoying. It is going to fundamentally alter the power of the one branch of non-elected, of one of the three branches of our government, the one that's not elected.
And we know it's not really about the Constitution.
Well, yes. I certainly feel that way. But that's not going to make a difference. I mean, this is a real problem, and this is a case, you know, they're going to wait for a case to come along and they're going to make a determination as to whether they want to wait and see if they get one more justice so that they can come back with a 6-3 decision as opposed to a 5-4 decision and make John Roberts feel like he is just calling balls and strikes. Or if they're concerned that they're going to lose those 5 votes, they will take a case like this. And it could come in the next term. It could come after that. But this is a sword of Damocles. I mean, look at all the things that we talked about on that day one agenda. The vast majority of that gone. Because the president can't direct these agencies to emphasize one part of the law or another, because the law would be deemed, if they were so inclined by the Supreme Court, to be insufficiently precise. It's a big deal. It's a big deal. And just mark this down, folks, because one day we're going to have, I don't know who it'll be, Ian Millhiser or someone else, who will come on and say, yeah, we're now in an era that is almost unprecedented in this country, but for, I think it was 8 months in 1935 or something.
All right, Brett Kavanaugh's liver, it's your time to shine.
Exactly.
And by shine, I mean send him to an early grave.
Well,
it'd be nice if we could figure out something about what was said in the closed session about his debts. Does that just disappear forever?
That disappears. I think I saw there was a I think there's a book that is suggesting that Kennedy really lobbied hard for Kavanaugh, and during that period is when his debts were paid off. Nice business if you can get it. But look, I mean, let's be clear. There are two things, really. Brett Kavanaugh's gambling debts notwithstanding. If it wasn't going to be Brett Kavanaugh, it would be someone else. The real issue is Mitch McConnell holding open that Merrick Garland seat and whatever, however you want to, wherever you want to lay the blame, it can be spread around. But Democrats, the lefts, whoever's failure it is, to make the voters appreciate the importance of the Supreme Court and allowing Donald Trump to fill that seat. Never mind the fact that he's filled over one quarter of the circuit court level of federal judges, all with lifetime appointments.
It'd be nice to see Obama talk about that.
It would be, except for Obama would have to acknowledge his abject failure at seeing the relevance of filling at least those seats on the federal judiciary. And I know about obstruction, folks, but in real time, you can go back and see activists. And I have no doubt that we talked about it on this program, complain that Obama was not sending nominations quick enough to the Senate when we controlled the Senate.
Thanks, Obama.
They were lackadaisical about it. And in real time, even before they nominated a justice, there was calls for Obama to nominate a justice for which there would be some measure of political price if Mitch McConnell obstructed. Right? Like, There was no constituency who were like refusing to give Merrick Garland a hearing is a fundamental offense to us. There was no constituency. But had Obama appointed a woman of color, a person of you know, a black man, a Latina woman, a black woman, a Latina man, an Asian man, an Asian woman, someone who would have had a provided at the very least a measure of diversity on the court and represented a breakthrough for a community in this country. There was, and you know, it's impossible to provide a counterfactual, but a better chance that you would have a political issue. And this is nothing I'm saying is profound or original or even retroactive. It was something that we were saying in the moment at the time. Plenty of people were. And so Obama's never going to bring this up because it points to one of his most significant failures, just from a pure, you know, like catching and fielding perspective.
Yeah, he needs to get off his high horse.
Yes, but I think that's the trouble with guys on a high horse. You can't reach him. They're too high up. The other thing I want to briefly talk about, and I was going to take calls, but I've been just going on. That stuff is very important. On your way back to Thanksgiving, all right, we'll talk about this in a bit, but let me tell you what I'm seeing right now. There is a full court press to do two things that reinforce each other. One is to push the narrative that Trump's reelection is, you know, a real possibility, which is true. But it's being tied in to this notion of Medicare for All is somehow going to sink the Democrats. And that is a sort of a bank shot way of saying you got to vote for Biden or you got to vote for Buttigieg. Or from Mike Bloomberg's perspective, when he does his third party race, if it's a run, if it's against a Warren or a Bernie Sanders, it's justified to save America. That's what's going on right now. Do not buy into it. The idea that people would be voting against Medicare for All, forget about it. Make Donald Trump argue on policy and Democrats will win. I don't care what the policy is. I mean, make policy the issue that Republicans think they're going to win on and Democrats will win. Every moment Donald Trump has to make a critique of policy is a win for Democrats. I don't care what the policy is. I mean, you could come out and say, we propose, and Jamie will enjoy this, we propose expropriation of every private dwelling over the size of 6 apartments in the country as a Democratic plank, and making Donald Trump argue against that will hurt Donald Trump. He does not want to argue policy. Now, I know there'll be a ton of outside expenditures and they'll all be talking about, you know, Bernie Sanders wants to get rid of private insurance. Elizabeth Warren wants to get rid of private insurance. I'm telling you, this race is going to be about Donald Trump. It's got to come out of Donald Trump's mouths to make a difference. And we're seeing, here's the one that's really ridiculous. Bring up the calculator. I'm sorry, folks. They voted Democratic. Now they support Trump. Okay, so just the headline itself, like, oh, geez, there's a net loss from 2016. They're going to vote for Trump, and they had never voted for Trump before, except for, no, that's not what it is. Midterm victories in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin gave Democrats hope of retaking the Rust Belt battleground states that handed the presidency to Donald J. Trump in 2016. Yet, the midterms might not mean as much for Democratic presidential candidates as the party might think. I don't know what the party thinks. You ready for this? Nearly 2/3 of voters in 6 battleground states who voted for Trump in 2016, but for Democratic congressional candidates in 2018, say they intend to vote for Trump again. In other words, there's an easier way of saying this. It appears like Trump has lost 1/3 of the people who voted for Democrats, Democratic congressional candidates in 2018. Now, look, we all know, because we've talked about it ad nauseum on this program, the reason why Democrats won in 2018 was not because of these people who voted for Trump and then voted for Democrats. It was because more people came out at a record level to vote for Democrats. More people came out to vote on a record level for Republicans on an off-year election. It's just that even more came out for the Democrats. So these people were not key to the Democrats' victory in 2018. But even if they were, you're still saying that Trump has lost. This is a way of saying, here is people saying they voted for Trump in 2016. They're not going to vote for him in 2020.
Stuck.
A third of those people. Now, those people, the group is only a sliver of the electorate, 2% of registered voters. It's not representative of all voters. Indeed. One would think if you vote for a Democrat in 2018, you're more inclined to vote for the presidential candidate. But again, this is all about mobilization. This is an argument that persuasion is irrelevant. Okay? But let's take that number. It's 1/3 of 2% of registered voters. Okay, now, I don't have the figures as to who that represents in 2018 because it's a different electorate pool. But we can tell you this, that in Pennsylvania, 2,970,733 voted for Trump in 2016.
Oh, God. Are we doing math right now?
Well, we have a calculator. 2,970,333. We need to know what 0.066 of those people will do in 2018, right? 2%. This is all back of the envelope stuff, but this is 2% of registered voters and 2/3 of them are going to vote for Trump again. So it's 1/3 are not going to vote for Trump. So 1/3 of 2%, 0.066. So multiply that times 0.066. Nope, you got to do multiplication. Got to go back one. No, nope, just go. Yeah, okay.
It's now not our strong suit.
No, this is not. Times 0.066 equals 196,000 people. Hillary Clinton lost by 44,000 votes in Pennsylvania. Now, my point isn't to say that the Democratic candidate is going to win Pennsylvania by 150,000 votes. My point is to say is that, like, this is a very weird framing for this piece of data. If you wanted to make the argument that there's a lot of voters that indicate, you know, get the sense that they want a divided government, that's one thing. But the idea that this is framed is like, there's a very tenuous margin here. Well, of course, everyone knows that. But there is a concerted effort that's going on in the media now to create this fear of loss and couple it, because this is not happening in a vacuum. It is happening at a time where there has been a concerted effort to attack Elizabeth Warren, mostly because I think a lot of these people don't believe that Bernie Sanders has a chance, even though all the polls say that. They're just not capable of wrapping their heads around it. That's just the reality.
It doesn't look like anything to them.
What's that?
It doesn't look like anything to them.
It doesn't look like anything to them. They're genuinely worried about Warren because I think they see her as a compromise candidate, but still landing far too left for them.
They don't want to compromise.
And they don't want her pushing Medicare for all. They do not want Medicare for all to be the position, even if it comes in a form that, you know, some on the left find to be, you know, two stages. Yeah. Insufficient. Two stages of legislation, whatever the plan is not or that her commitment to it isn't there. The bottom line is the narrative would be that she ran on this and won with it. And how it gets implemented, you know, who knows? But the point being, they don't want that to happen. And so you're seeing millions upon millions of dollars spent to push this message that Medicare for all will kill the Democrats' chance in the Democrats' chance in 2020, that even people who are inclined to go Democratic, it's not such a shoo-in. This is what's going on now, folks, and you should be aware of it. As we head home and you try and like tell your concerned parents and friends and brothers and sisters.
Yeah, it's so dumb because Medicare for All is not unpopular at all. I mean, it varies from poll to poll, but like this one from American Barometer says it's 70% of Americans support Medicare for All.
A lot of it is a function of how it's asked. A lot of it is a function of the Democratic primary. You've seen Democrats attacking it, and the media is attacking it. If it was the position of the Democratic nominee, these people would have to be quiet. Buttigieg couldn't be out there saying that this is a problem.
Even Trump made it sound like he was going to give everyone health care when he was like, oh, it's going to be better health care. It's going to be much, much cheaper.
I understand. But the reality is that they are winning the messaging war. And part of it, frankly, is the attacks on Elizabeth Warren's plan, because it's a two-stage plan and requires two pieces of legislation, is also creating this sense. And part of it is also a function of like her feeling like she needed, and by her, I mean her campaign, feeling like she needed to show the financing and to actually roll out with a specific plan, I think showed some measure of a lack of confidence in the politics of Medicare for All. And people jump on that. And frankly, when the attacks on Warren about the two-stage plan, regardless of, I think it warrants some critique, but the broader critique that is levied on her is hurting Medicare for All. There's no doubt about it. It is because the average American who will show up in a poll now where it says only 36% support it, as opposed to 52% or something to that effect, they just hear that there's controversy about something. There's nobody, like your average American is not looking at, they just hear that there's controversy about it. And that scares them. Because the last thing you want is controversy as to whether you're going to get health care or not.
Do you really think controversy from the left is making it through into the mainstream discourse, though?
I think controversy does, yes. I don't think that there are people out there going like, well, no, I'm a little shaky on Medicare for All now because I'm hearing about Elizabeth Warren having a two-stage plan and this and that. No,
yeah, they're not reading Megan Day's critiques in Jacobin.
Absolutely not. But that's what I'm saying. All they're getting is that there's controversy about it, period. Controversy, not from the left, not from the right, controversy. And the more controversy there is about something that is so closely held as a value, healthcare, the more worried people get. And then they run from it. That's basically it. That's the bottom line. Particularly at this stage in the election, people just get broad emotional signals. And so, no, they don't know the specifics of the controversy. They don't know if it's coming from the right or the left. I don't even know that they would know that there is a debate about it. Two different ideological poles. But I do know that that is getting through. You can talk to, it makes people worry about it, and they don't even need to know the specifics as to why. And so
people just need to uncuck themselves and vote for what they want.
Well,
now I'm blaming the electorate.
Yeah, but there's a lot of people. They don't have the time to figure out. They don't know. They don't have like the assets to make that determination. I mean, you know, like, I don't know what chemicals do I want banned? I have no idea. I have no idea. The bad ones.
You know you want healthcare, though.
I do want healthcare.
People want healthcare.
Right, but it is not obvious to the overwhelmingly large part of the United States, like, what's the best healthcare policy?
Well, that's one thing that's good about Medicare for All, is that it's actually really simple to understand and relatively simple to implement.
I don't think you're right. I think that if you sat down with somebody, you could explain it to them. But I think from an American's, your average person's perspective, like, they understand, like, yes, could I get free healthcare? I like that. But then, wait a second, I'm going to lose my healthcare? Wait a second. How am I going to get free healthcare? Oh, you're going to lose your healthcare. Oh, maybe this sounds too good to be true. That's the way that goes. And then those people who want a Democrat to win go like, this seems like, I mean, we're having this argument about healthcare. How about we don't have an argument about healthcare and we just win? That's the way the mentality goes. And we don't necessarily like it or whatnot. But I mean, I think like to ignore that reality, I think we do so at our own peril. Let's go to the phones. Colin from a 847 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Josh from Chicago.
Josh from Chicago. What's on your mind, Josh?
I wanted to talk about two things and also get your advice. The annual family Thanksgiving stuff.
Okay.
About how to talk to your more neoliberal family members. But first, I want to pick up on something that John was talking about yesterday. There was a new poll that came out today in New Hampshire, I think yesterday night, that showed Bernie at 26%, Buttigieg at 22%, and then everyone else pretty far behind. And to me, I think the one thing that John didn't talk about that I think to me is consistent looking at these polls, and you guys have sort of mentioned it, is that the problem with Buttigieg and Warren and a lot of these other people's support is that the less diverse support you have, the less strong your base is going to be. And I think what might end up happening in a lot of these states is that Warren, Buttigieg, and even maybe even Harris, even though she's at 3%, they might end up splitting a lot of their vote, and it's going to be easier for Bernie to get up on top for some of these states.
I mean, look.
I think especially because Buttigieg's support does not
polls,
seem to be very strong.
These polls are all over the place, but I've seen plenty of polls that show Buttigieg has the most diverse support of anybody short of black folks. Now, in Iowa and New Hampshire, it's not going to make that much of a difference. South Carolina, in Nevada, it's different, and maybe in these later states. But who knows what happens if Buttigieg comes in second or first in one of those two states?
I mean, I think the thing is that I guess what I'm trying to say is, like, diverse might be the wrong term. I think a lot of these upper class white people, that support isn't very sturdy.
Buttigieg, in the polls that I saw, Buttigieg, the non-college non-college educated and college educated support that Buttigieg had was almost exactly equal.
Yeah, but are they committed to, I mean,
I don't know.
This isn't the same. I mean, we saw in that Iowa poll, 71% were committed to strongly to supporting Bernie. I guess what I'm saying is how strongly are these people committed? It seems to jump around, like Warren seemed to have a stretch where she was strong.
Right. I guess my point is that, like, you know, you can get too caught up in the polls at this point.
I mean, I agree. And I think people should keep phone banking. And do less poll watching, but just like an observation that I think Bernie does have very sturdy support that can grow. I guess what I'm saying. And
well,
I agree
that he has his support has a floor that nobody else's has. From the beginning, though, it's also clear that he has one of the lowest ceilings, at least in terms of polling, than anybody else. But that ceiling is sufficient, I think, to win the nomination. So, you know, we'll see. I mean, I think, like, because we know that so much this sentiment is out there, and frankly, this is completely the most predictable thing in the world. In fact, I think I said it in that debate I had with Jimmy Dore. I remember the feeling when Bill Clinton won and looking around the room and everybody's going like, oh, thank God. And just thinking like, ugh, really? Like, I mean, I'm glad Bush is gone, too, but really? And that is the feeling that people have after these things. And so their desire to have somebody they're convinced is going to win is paramount. And so what happens in these early states is huge and probably even more determinative than it has been in other years.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. I mean, guess what polls are saying that Buttigieg has such diverse support?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, I saw it yesterday. There was one. I mean, they're all around. Just go to your favorite, you know, site, depending on, you know, I'm sure Nate Silver has them. the ones that show his support is diverse. I mean, he has very, very, very tiny black support. But frankly, the only person who has strong black support is Biden. And then Bernie has decent. And then nobody else has black
support. And he has very strong Latino support, though.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess my other question is, you know, you do your annual how to talk to your family members. I have family members in my extended family who are like, who really like Pete and who also will send me articles where they're like, it's interesting that Thomas Friedman likes Michael Bloomberg. Maybe you should give this a read. How do I talk to these people? Because I feel like it's almost harder to talk to them than it is like conservative people right now.
I think you talk to them about electability. I think you say, like, look, Pete Buttigieg is never going to get black support. And without black support, real passionate black support, the Democrats will lose. Period. End of story. Michael Bloomberg, same problem. These are not controversial positions. You can show them. You can show them facts, and then you can show them. You can show them numbers, and then you can show them reasons why. I would say for people like that, I would keep it all about non-ideological things.
All right, great.
And just show them the polls, and then you just say, and then the argument is like, well, then why not Biden? And you go like, would you hire Joe Biden to do? Would you let Joe Biden carry around, like, if somebody's just had a baby, like, how long would you allow Joe Biden to carry on that baby without feeling a little bit nervous? Like, that's the way I would express that. Good luck, Josh.
Yeah.
Report back.
Thank you.
All right. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Thanks, buddy. Thanks for all your participation in the show this year. Much appreciated. And thank you for dry cleaning the shirt. Calling from a 484 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 484?
Hi, this is me.
Yes, it is.
Hi, this is me.
Yes, it is.
Hey, Sam, how you doing?
Good.
How's it going?
Who's
long
this?
Long-time fan. So, yeah, I wanted to talk about Columbia, if that's possible.
Who is this?
My name is Cody. I'm calling from PA.
Cody from PA. What's on your mind? Columbia.
Yeah. So right now there are general strikes actually going on throughout the country. This is all happening against the backdrop of President Álvaro Uribe. He was a former president, and he's on trial now essentially for a litany of crimes. The current president, Duque, is pretty much seen as a puppet of Uribe. And people are pretty much fed up. I have family members starting to post all over the place about what's been going on. It's unfortunate, but there's like looting going on. But the posts I'm seeing about the looting is like people stealing food. And I'm also seeing police looting, and they're stealing flat screen TVs. It's just a really bad situation. And I would really appreciate it if you could just like put that out there to your audience and maybe get them involved. I know there's about 1.5 million Colombians in the tri-state. So, it's just it's a powder keg. Duque is like known as pretty much the Colombian Bolsonaro, and we all know how much we love that guy. Mm. So it's tough. It's scary. And I appreciate all the work that you guys do. It's incredible. It's important. And thank you so much.
All right. We'll try and pay a little more attention to what's going on there. It's pretty nuts right now.
Yeah, things are popping off all over the world. It's kind of inspiring, actually. I mean, the circumstances aren't good, but the resistance is.
I couldn't really hear Jamie. Sorry.
She was saying it's a little bit inspiring, very inspiring, that the resistance is good. The circumstances are not so great, but the people are popping off a little bit. Well, appreciate the call. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Thanks, Cody.
Thanks.
Calling from a 478 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Do declare this is Jeff from Georgia, Sam. How are you today?
Jeff from Georgia. Happy early Thanksgiving.
And a happy early Thanksgiving to you, the whole crew there. Appreciate you guys being a part of my universe. It's quite a pleasure to be a part of your show. I wanted to talk a little bit about Matt Lieberman down here in Georgia, if you'd like.
I would, yes. Joe Lieberman's son.
I've done a little bit of looking. Yeah, exactly.
Yep.
I've done a little bit of looking into him. In all seriousness, and I've become convinced that he is getting into the race. He's a good actual microcosm of where the right wing of the Democratic Party is, I think. He made his bones, in all the write-ups you'll see, him called a businessman or an entrepreneur, and they won't tell you much beyond that. What he did was consulting for a company that would stand between, say, your large employer and the insurance company that they decide to go with. And they'll do all the negotiations for you, and they'll process your systems and get all your shit, you know, set up for you. You know, taking a good bit off the top for themselves, of course, which is an industry, you know, that frankly is a parasite upon a parasite.
Yes, it's true.
If you catch it.
I do.
And he's come out really strongly for a public option in his Senate campaign. That's the one thing they've been able to pin him down on. And I think it's because he has seen the writing on the wall that the best way forward for, say, him 10 years ago or his current business partners and associates now is to funnel as many sick and old and poor people into that public program as they can so that they can preserve this carve out that they've got going so that they can continue to suck blood off of this blood-sucking tick that is the American health insurance industry. And paradoxically, to me, this is all just more of a reason to support Bernie Sanders and no one else, because this is the kind of obstacle we're going to face on the left in the United States government, particularly in the Senate, which is going to be a huge problem in the coming decades to getting any kind of legislation or substantial change passed. And these states that we're looking at, like Georgia or maybe Texas in the next 10 years, 20 years or so, that might flip to the Democratic Party, these are the kind of Democrats are going to put up in front of you.
Yep.
And, you know, beyond what we do about all that, you know, and strong primary challenges, where we can get them, I don't really know what else to do about that. It's actually a pretty grim scenario to think about it. But on the positive side, you know, he does represent a little bit of a shift in that they realize they can't run on everything's fine.
Right.
Healthcare needs no attention, because that's obviously just not the case. People know that. You know, they get anxious when you talk about healthcare, understandably, but they also know that a lot of that anxiety comes from the fact that they don't actually have a lot of control over their healthcare. Their employer does, or the government does.
It's also why.
And we have to choose. Go ahead. Sorry.
Well, support for Medicare for All and supporting, you know, candidates who literally just utter the words Medicare for All on some level. It forces candidates like Lieberman to shift to the left, to create the rightward parameters of this debate. The further to the left that we can move those rightward parameters, at least within the Democratic Party, the better. Right. I mean, this is, we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit in terms of legislatively, but in terms of like forcing them their rhetoric at this point, you know, so that the center of where the party is on healthcare moves to the left. I mean, you know, there's an argument that Sanders should be out there pushing, genuinely socialized medicine delivery, just to essentially, you know, force the Pete Buttigieg's to land where they were before, which is at Medicare for All. Right. And so it is a good sign that Lieberman's doing that. And we're going to have to go through. We're not going to end up tomorrow where there's a full blown progressive in the, you know, winning the Senate seat in Georgia. It's just not going to happen.
No, it's not going to happen.
But this is, you know, and that's the reality that we're going to be facing. You're right. We're going to have, if the Democrats take the Senate, short of maybe Maine, all of those votes, and I'm not even sure about Maine, and, you know, we'll see what happens in Colorado. It'd be nice if we had Romanoff, but I don't know if that's going to happen. But if the Democrats take the Senate, more than likely, those senators who are elected to help the Democrats take the Senate are going to be the biggest obstacles to this. That's just sort of...
Yes, and, they're going to be living. That's why I want to support Bernie Sanders above all other candidates, even Elizabeth Warren, who I don't think is as bad as some people do, because he's the only one with a vision of massive political mobilization, getting way more people, way more involved in politics than they have been previously. And that is the only force that has a chance of possibly peacefully moving these people where we need to. I know yesterday you hosted a young man on your show who suggested maybe we could motivate them to go in a different way. I don't want to go that way. I really, you know, all joking aside, I don't think that, you know,
that's not a successful recipe. No, but I agree with you. And I think that's the hope with Bernie. I don't know how realistic it is, but certainly I think that hope lies there. And
I think it's worth a try.
Well, absolutely. I agree.
My podcast is worth listening to, and that I've taken up too much of your time, Sam.
Jeff, have a great Thanksgiving. Thanks, man. Appreciate
it. Happy Thanksgiving, Jordan Ford. I love you guys.
Appreciate you.
Happy Thanksgiving,
you calling it.
Jeff. We love you too.
All right, let me take one more call, and then we'll do a couple of these clips, and then I'll get back to the calls. Calling from a 267 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 267.
Hello, this is Brad calling from Philadelphia. How are you doing today, Sam?
Good. Hi, Brad. What's on your mind?
Yeah, I was actually reading through a big document from Reuters today. It was dealing with how judges have been sealing the court documents on public harm cases throughout like all the decades. It was referring to what happened with Remington, what happened with the opioid crisis, what happened with the GM crisis as well. And it really just goes to show that whenever a product liability case would be taken to a judge, they're supposed to say that they're supposed to give the reasonings for why they would seal the court documents. But this was a really big, like in-depth Reuters breakdown. In up to 85% of the cases, they don't provide the reasoning for why they're sealing the documents. And this has led to like multiple times of just more and more people dying. There was a court case that took place in West Virginia. I believe it started in 2001 and it was finally settled in 2004, where Purdue was lobbying to have everything redacted or sealed behind the documents. And they were unable to get the information out to the general public, which has continued to, you know, promote the opioid epidemic, the opioid crisis that's like going through like a big part of the country. And like it's like a 32-minute article that I've been reading today, you know, through the Reuters piece. But it's really just damning how we've allowed like not only large corporations to get behind their team of legal entities and just seal all of these documents. That way the people, you know, can't have the information. Have you heard many things about this? I mean, I'm sure.
Well, yes. In fact, the Remington one, I would encourage you to go back. I don't know when it was. Maybe we can pull it up. But
the Remington one, you're talking about the faulty trigger firing?
Yes. And I interviewed a public interest attorney at the tort conference that I go to in Vegas. And he told me that whole story about 3 or 4 years ago. And how, at the very least, like there was a man who was involved in a case, and his son, I think, died, and he went through a case where he got a settlement, and they solved it. Here it is. It was in April 28th, 2017. I really go back and listen to it. It's harrowing. In fact, if I remember correctly, I literally had to stop in the middle of the interview. It was so disturbing. And it was a story of a man who was bound by a confidentiality and was ready to go to jail to basically tell the public of what was going on. So yes, I'm very aware of this. And send me the article to majorityreporters@gmail.com. I would just add this.
Yeah, I can send that to you.
The trial lawyers,
the one big part from
the trial lawyers are hugely important in terms of attempting to change the behavior of these companies. But what you're pointing to shows the limitations of what they can do. Because ultimately, you know, the way that they temper the behavior of these corporations is by changing their cost benefit analysis, right? Like we're going to make it cost more than you had anticipated. So you go ahead, you make your profits, and you think, okay, we're going to get caught and we're going to have to pay 25% VIG on this if we ever do get caught. And, you know, the trial lawyers try and make it like you're paying a 45% VIG or you're taking a bigger hit in the court of opinion or, you know, the public opinion, whatever it is. And that changes some behavior to a certain extent. But and because it's about taking money and providing money for the plaintiffs have an incentive to say like, okay, I'm going to take this award from the jury and I'll sign that NDA. I'll agree to have it be sealed because I want to move on with my life. This has been a long process. It shows the limitations of that. I mean, it is necessary, but insufficient. It shows the limitations
from the Reuters article. Stevens, the original judge that sealed the opioid trials, he was quoted as, "It happened, and that's all I can say about it. It speaks for itself," when Reuters reached out to him to comment if he would be second-guessing his decision. And then In their unprecedented analysis, Reuters found over the past 20 years, judges sealed evidence relevant to public health and safety in about half of the 115 biggest defective product cases consolidated before federal judges in so-called multi-district litigations, yep, or MDLs. Those cases comprised nearly 250,000 individual death and injury lawsuits involving dozens of products, medical devices, and the numbers don't convey the full extent of information locked away because they don't include thousands of product liability cases heard in state courts. So it's really important that we bring awareness to this, because like this is a way that like the judges, yep, aren't even representing the people that they're supposed to be defending.
Yep. I agree. Appreciate the call, Brad. Have a happy Thanksgiving.
Bye.
All right. Let's, speaking of Thanksgiving, ladies and gentlemen, as you know, around here, we're starting to gear up for the war on Christmas. And I want to be frank about something. We were caught a little bit asleep at the wheel. We do our best to be on top of things. I think if you read as much Sun Tzu as I do, you'd be embarrassed. We thought we had the high terrain. We didn't realize that there was actually a higher terrain behind us. We were preparing for the battle in front of us, but we forgot about the one behind us. I'm making all that up. I don't know if that's in Sun Tzu. But here's Donald Trump striking the first and almost, because we're almost past it, final blow in the war on Thanksgiving.
But make sure you register to vote. As we gather together for Thanksgiving, you know, some people want to change the name Thanksgiving. They don't want to use the term Thanksgiving. And that was true also with Christmas, but now everybody's using Christmas again. Remember I said that? But now we're going to have to do a little work on Thanksgiving. People have different ideas why it shouldn't be called Thanksgiving. But everybody in this room I know loves the name Thanksgiving, and we're not changing it. But Americans have so much to be thankful for. The economy is booming. Wages are rising. Crime is falling. Poverty is plummeting. Confidence is soaring.
Yeah, God, I can't hear that part. But this is, he caught us plotting. We were going to roll this out in 2020, the war on Thanksgiving, and he preempted us.
It is true that we want to change the name to Thanks-taking, because, of course, we are takers.
It's either Thanks-taking or just sort of like...
I thought Reparations-giving.
Reparations-giving is one of them.
Or Sorry-giving, one of those two.
I just... I
apologize for being white-giving.
I just wanted to call it Shanksgiving, just so that like people will be like, what? Happy Shanksgiving. I'm sorry. Did you say Happy Shanksgiving?
That'd be super irritating.
Wouldn't it? That was basically my agenda, but he just quashed all of it. What is he talking about? He's made that up. I've never heard anybody who's talked about changing the name of Thanksgiving. Did he get confused with like Columbus Day?
It's very possible.
He just assumes that every holiday the left wants to change now.
What will we come for next?
I mean, I've been working very hard to make sure Friday maintains the name Friday, and it's worked so far. So you're welcome, everybody.
There you go. Exactly.
A lot of people want to change that. But
not enough people give Matt credit for maintaining the integrity of Friday. Everybody's saying it. Yeah. Everybody is saying it.
Everybody's still saying it. You're going to call it Friday this week.
When I record the intro for Friday, I'm going to call it Friday.
You just did.
You're
twice.
Welcome.
What's the day after Thursday? Ask Matt. It's Friday. Boom.
A regular Rebecca Black over here.
We're winning the fight, folks.
There you go. So congratulations, Matt, on Friday. Congratulations, Trump, on Thanksgiving. He gets... So on the impeachment front, what you're going to hear next week on the 4th, I guess that's a week from today, the Judiciary Committee is going to have a hearing on not the facts of the case, but they're going to take the report from the Intelligence Committee, and they're going to hear from constitutional scholars as to whether Donald Trump's actions meet the standard of high crimes and misdemeanors or bribery, or both, for that matter. They'll be having hearings on next Wednesday. The facts in this case are more or less completely resolved. I mean, I don't know how much more resolved they can be. Now today we heard that there was testimony that was released that showed that two officials at the OMB, the Office of Management and Budget, resigned because they were baffled by why the money was being held up, the security aid was being held up to Ukraine. We also found out today, it was reported, that White House lawyers gave Donald Trump a heads up on the whistleblower report. And subsequent to that, a couple of days, they released the money. In other words, the cops are here. The cops are here.
The money got released anyway.
That's right. I never took the money out of the safe because the cops got me in the lobby of the bank with the guns that I had. That's basically what's going on. Yet they will continue to argue every single point here and deny, deny, deny. And it's not just Trump. Here is Senator Joe Kennedy. He's from Louisiana, right? Where's Kennedy from? And he was on Fox News Sunday with Chris Wallace. Here's what he had to say about, now he's going to back off this, but not in this clip, because that's not the way they do. It's one thing to say something on Fox, and then I'll go to a different network and say something different. That's the game that's being played here. People should be clear on this. Here's Joe Kennedy refusing to acknowledge that the Russians were responsible for any hacking that took place in 2016.
The president and his supporters have said that Ukraine was behind the hacking of the DNC computers and that it wasn't Russia. Mm-hmm. That was a big issue this week because former NSC official Fiona Hill said that that is Russian disinformation. She debunked that. But on the other hand, President Trump doubled down on that the very next day. Take a look, sir.
This is a fictional narrative that has been perpetrated and propagated by the Russian security services themselves.
They gave the server to CrowdStrike, or whatever it's called, which is a company owned by a very wealthy Ukrainian. And I still want to see that server. You know, the FBI has never gotten that server. That's a big part of this whole thing.
Senator Kennedy, who do you believe was responsible for hacking the DNC and Clinton campaign computers, their emails? Was it Russia or Ukraine?
I don't know, nor do you, nor do any of us. Miss Hill,
interrupt to say the entire intelligence community says it was Russia.
Right, but it could also be Ukraine. I'm not saying that I know one way or the other. I'm saying that Miss Hill is entitled to her opinion, but no rebuttal evidence was allowed to be offered. We know. At least the Republicans in the House wanted to call a witness, a DNC political operative, who lobbied the Ukrainian embassy to get involved in the 2016 election. We don't know if Ukraine did that. We don't know to what extent, because they won't let the president offer his evidence. And that's why I'll say once again, the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence if you're not allowed to call your own witnesses.
Yeah, the thing is, though, is that it's been resolved with the 17 intelligence agencies, and there is no credible evidence, period. There's just simply no credible evidence. And he'll go on Fox News. He will spread that lie because he knows, as we have said here many times, and everybody seems to know now, there are two different narratives of reality. And Fox News is to deliver one. Everywhere else is to deliver the other. And they don't. Here's the thing. Michelle Bachmann, back during the Obama years, gave a response to the State of the Union for the Tea Party. And there's video of her doing this, and it provides a I came up with a principle, I think, at the time. Because Michelle Bachmann was doing a direct feed to the Tea Party, but they also had another feed on her from CNN. They were not the same cameras. So this is the Bachmann principle. Here it is from 2016. Watch her speech.
But the problem that he has now is, like, how does he hold his base?
Let's go. Let's just go see. No, go see if you can find the actual clip of her doing it. Normal
people, the non-Tea Party.
Okay, see, here she is speaking. And I wish we had blown that up at the time. But you can see that she is talking to the Tea Party camera. But the CNN camera that is watching her, it looks very weird. So, in other words, this is the Tea Party camera right in front of me. Or this is the CNN camera right in front of me. And I'm talking to the Tea Party camera. And I'm talking like I am talking directly to camera. But instead, it looks like I'm sort of somewhat crazy. Because I don't realize that I'm not looking at you. And that's the way it used to be. It used to be that you could not talk to these two audiences simultaneously and not seem crazy to one of them. Now they realize they don't have to talk to the same audience at the same time. That they can actually make each representation different, and they could do, because they are so defined and discrete from each other. And so he goes on CNN, and it's a completely different story.
Here it is. I was answering one of his questions, and he interjected a statement and asked me to react to it. What I heard Chris say was he made the statement that only Russia had tried to interfere in the election. And I answered the question. That's not what he said. I went back and looked at the transcript. He said only Russia tried to hack the DNC computer. Now, Chris is right. I was wrong. The only evidence I have, and I think it's overwhelming, is that it was Russia who tried to hack the DNC computer. I've seen no indication that Ukraine tried to do it.
Yes. So he's going on to say that, though, that they did interfere in the election. Now, look, here's the thing. All the evidence that he supposedly saw about the hack also included any assessment of any other interference in the election. It's not like the CIA and the 17 intelligence agencies said, we're just going to tell you about one attempt. They lay out all of it. He knows there's no evidence of Ukraine doing anything. But he needs to go back on CNN so he doesn't look like a complete raging lunatic, mostly to his colleagues. But what his colleagues may not realize, maybe they do, is that none of the people he said the first thing to are going to see the second one. They're never going to see it. There's no way for them to see it. Fox is not going to run it. They're never going to see it. Mark Levin is not going to run it. Nobody's going to, it's not, they're not going to see it. That's the bottom line. That's the thing they understand. Let's play number five. Look, between the non-delegation doctrine, between the chances of Trump winning, between the Supreme Court being dominated by Republicans for decades, not a lot of hope for the future. I'm not saying it's hopeless, but we haven't been able to deliver a lot of hope today. Well, today, in this moment, I should say, we're going to bring you some hope. This is some students from a middle and high school students in Baltimore as Melania Trump goes out and gives an opioid awareness speech. Now, just the idea that you would go on an opioid awareness tour to high school students is indicative of you trying to obfuscate what the problem has been and is, right? Like this is not, the opioid abuse came from over prescriptions of prescription drugs that were sold under false pretenses, in some instances, were sold with a full awareness that there was abuse going on, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And a world that promotes alienation, malaise, disconnection, and not to mention like material poverty.
There's some of that, although there was a report that came out yesterday, and I've mentioned this before, but now apparently the report has been finished by a NIBAR study that African Americans suffered a disproportionate amount of deaths during the opioid crisis because doctors, it's twofold. One, they lacked insurance. Two, doctors have a racial bias when it comes to acknowledging pain. And so they prescribed black people less opioids and there were less deaths. And there's no reason to believe that the immiseration rates for black people and white people were significantly different. Now, you may have pockets of despair where it's all white towns. But the but for in this instance is the readiness and the availability that they had to getting opioid prescriptions.
Yeah, it's a perfect storm of factors.
Indeed. Indeed. But high school students are not going and in a position to go to their doctors and say, don't give me opioids. It's absurd. So kudos to these middle school and high school students who provide, even though they're in Baltimore, a Bronx cheer to the First Lady.
Jim, for the warm introduction and for inviting me to join you today for such an important event centered on opioid awareness. I'm in this fight with you and I'm fighting for you. I encourage you, if you are struggling with addiction right now, reach out for support. Whether it's a teacher, parent, friend, grandparent, coach or pastor, talk to an adult in your life that you trust. It is never too late to ask for help.
Yeah, booze.
You know those scared straight programs where you bring
yes,
and how they have the reverse effect? Actually, there's been studies.
Oh, is that right?
Actually, yeah, you basically can help. I don't know what the mechanism is, but it can have the reverse effect. I feel like this is a similar thing.
They meet a bunch
thing.
Of cool criminals.
This is like you hear about, too many people are asking their doctor for opioids when they have pain or something, whatever the logic of
right.
this message is here, and then they're going to probably do it. I don't know.
It's basically just her going out and saying, like, if things are tough, ask for help to somebody.
Be best.
Unbelievable. I mean, good for her, I guess. Who knows? Like, I don't know what her level of awareness is of any of it.
It'd be nice if you call out the Sacklers by name.
Exactly.
She really doesn't care, do you?
My guess is that she doesn't really care.
I mean, I think she's worn fashion to that precise.
I think so.
That's what I'm getting at.
Just a coincidence.
Yeah, yeah. You know, you
just a coincidence,
believe
I'm sure.
The things that people tell you.
Indeed. This was pretty great. The annual Harvard-Yale game took place in New Haven this year. That's the football game. During halftime, protesters stormed the field. 42 people were charged for their role in disrupting the game. I don't know if they did it during halftime or they did it actually during the game or right before they were about to start, maybe the second half. And both Harvard and Yale football players, came out with statements in support of it. But here it is. Here's the clip.
The kickers are trying to set up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They have a sign that says nobody wins. Harvard and Yale are complicit in climate injustice. This is good stuff. Weird. Donald Trump did not attack them. Isn't it? A little weird.
You'd think that he would, because they're coastal elites.
Yeah. Although, I also suspect that the proportion of white to black people in that protest was not sufficient or appropriate for him to speak up. Here is, this is the Wesley Augsbury?
Yep.
He is the, I think, the captain of the Harvard football team. Gives a message of solidarity with the protesters. Is that who it is, Brendan? Okay.
Hi, my name is Wesley Augsbury, and I'm a senior in Leverhulse and the captain of the Harvard football team. Today we face off in the game, competing with our great rivals from New Haven, Yale. But at this moment, both of our institutions continue to invest in the industries destroying our futures. And when it comes to the climate crisis, no one wins. Harvard and Yale can't claim to truly promote knowledge while at the same time supporting the companies engaged in misleading the public, smearing academics, and denying the truth. That's why we're joining together with our friends at Yale to call for change. In solidarity with my friends at Fossil Fuel Divest Harvard and Fossil Free Yale, who disrupted today's proceedings, many of my teammates and I are wearing orange wristbands, the color of the divest movement, after the game. We're coming together to call upon Presidents Bacow and Salovey to divest from the fossil fuel industry now, for the sake of our generation.
Good stuff. Love how his roommate wouldn't turn the TV off. Hey, dude, I got to make a big political statement because I'm captain of the... Come on, man. Watching the game. You know, I'm watching whatever it is. Playing video games. And, of course, though, here is Fox and Friends bringing on a, future Republican, current Republican, to talk about how, I don't know, bad it is that people are protesting the destruction of the planet.
One of the things they were trying to do was they were trying to demand the university stop funding and investing money in fossil fuel companies. But at the same time, when you think about it, if they did that and they abandoned those kind of investments, you say the first thing the university would have to do then is probably cut financial aid to students and to things to
pause it. Can someone get me the endowments of these?
Harvard is $40.9 billion.
$40.9 billion with a B dollars. And if they divest from fossil fuel companies, presumably that will wipe out their $40.9 billion. What? Really? Where does this kid go to school?
This guy's no Economics 100.
This kid goes to Harvard?
Yeah. A lot of dumb people at Harvard. Folks.
Or he's in the theater department.
Or the business
And he's
department.
Just doing a theater piece. Here we go.
And they abandoned those kind of investments. You say the first thing the university would have to do then is probably cut financial aid to students and to things to students who really need that money.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, the university's endowment principally is designed to take care of all the things in the university that need funding. Some of the things, the cream of the crop, the things that are quite luxuries, like Harvard's great financial aid program, rely on this endowment to perform. It's ironic that the people that are taking the field...
Pause it. Do you know, like, let's say you get, like, I don't know, 5% interest on that $40.9 billion?
But financial aid is a luxury.
Yeah. No, they're not going to. They're going to have to cut back on the sweet snacks at the in the dormitories if they. I mean, this is, wow. This guy's like auditioning. Like, I just want every Republican campaign to know out there that I'm willing to go on TV and lie through my teeth.
luxuries, like Harvard's Great Financial Aid Program, rely on this endowment to perform. It's ironic that the people that are taking the field, these uneducated protesters that just want blanket action, they're the ones that are saying, I don't care if the endowment has bad returns. I want this very simple ban on fossil fuels, not in our general climate as a university, but just in the way we hold stocks as an endowment, which, by the way, as a protester, I have no expertise on. Yeah, I think it's kind of funny that they'd be the first ones to leave that field for a different reason, the field of Harvard University, because they wouldn't have funding to go to school anymore.
Oh, okay. So it was the poor, uneducated kids from Harvard that were apparently protesting. This guy, what's Christopher Colby?
Harvard really can educate some conservatives.
Yeah. There you go. Future Supreme Court pick.
Oh my God.
Party with Kavanaugh.
There you go.
Shout out to class traitors, though. We need more of those types.
I mean, I imagine there is a decent amount of people who go to Harvard, a significant amount, who get financial aid. But I don't think there's going to be a problem
legacy
with the $40 billion.
I think the luxury might just be more the legacy admissions. I guess they probably get their money's worth from that.
Exactly. So. Retcon. In that recent study about MSNBC's treatment of Bernie Sanders, Chris Hayes' show had the third highest negative coverage of Bernie. It was mostly guests' opinion, but kind of depressing. Love him and his podcast and books. I got to look at that. I mean, I suspect it's probably a function because on other programs, they don't cover him at all. They're just looking at the evening lineup. Well, if it's the third highest, there's only three shows on the primetime. Oh, seven? Oh, right. Oh, yeah. Four. That surprises me. I will take a look at it. But I can tell you that I rarely get on there now to talk about the primary. Rarely. Eggs and Marxism. Trump definitively made up the "they're trying to change Thanksgiving" folks after hearing someone talk about their Friendsgiving party one time. I don't even think he heard that. JJ Cool, I bet you could get Trump to promote the majority report by suggesting it be called Trump's Giving. Is it possible you get a cabinet position too? Brock from VA, never seen anyone blink as much as when they lie as Kennedy just did. Chris from Ohio, I want you to wrap. I want to wrap you up in a cute little Thanksgiving sweater, you cute dorky boomer. Thank you. That's very sweet. That's very sweet. Mojack, what do you think it would take to get more left moderators for a DNC primary debate? Not necessarily this cycle. People like you, Cenk, Crystal Ball, Ryan Grimm, etc. I think it would take some type of large meteor.
Maybe a wormhole to another reality.
Exactly.
Yeah, the way to do that would be to try to find some way to get candidates to do an independent panel.
Son of Spam. Hey, MR gang. Sam, you forgot to thank your awesome coworkers for making your show so great. Well, I was going to wait till the end of the program. Also, I don't want to be too much of a scientific pederast, but you can make something move indefinitely using magnets. It's the El Dorado of classical physics, the perpetual motion machine disproved by the second law of thermodynamics. You can't make something move indefinitely. Okay. Anyway, the MOVA globes are driven by light. Check them out in the dark. They stop moving. Is that right?
That's correct, yeah.
What?
That sounds like witchcraft to me.
It's magnets and light, I think.
What?
That's what my understanding was.
I don't believe it. Colin from Nebraska. We may or may not need to hire our ANCAP friend from Minnesota to quote unquote haggle with the Republican majority in the Supreme Court. Rube Davin. Hey, Sam, I remember not being involved in politics in 2010. And my understanding about the ACA is that both ends were unhappy. So it must be a good compromise. I was wrong then. And that's how uninformed people will think now. Indeed. I think that's true. Kevin M. Did you see guy's ex on Twitter, Harvard guy?
Oh yeah, some woman said that she just broke up with him and she feels vindicated after seeing him go.
Oh, that's funny.
I mean, he's a campus reform guy, so she should have known earlier.
Mean probably. Kitty, did I miss the Janine Thanksgiving Day show? If so, what episode was she on this year? Sadly, Janine couldn't make it in. She was going to LA today. Glasses Gull. One minor point I picked up from the hearings was just how big a proportion of our diplomats' work is facilitating U.S. companies' dealings abroad. Seems like that's half of what they do. Indeed, of course. And that's fine, I guess, but add that to the list with the FAA and the highways of what we all do for them. Without a doubt, That's more than half of what we do. That could be 95% of what they do. Not necessarily directly. Maybe 50% of it's direct, and the other 45% of it is like indirect. We're just trying to create a better context for U.S. Companies to do business here. That type of thing.
It's not trying to give people their rights?
Colin from a 310. Yeah, their rights to work for a U.S. company. Cheaply. Colin from a 310 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? 310. No? Let's try calling from a 954 area code.
Hey, Sam. This is Yoshi from Miami.
Yoshi from Miami. What's on your mind?
Actually, I'm a friend of the friend of the show, a long time, first time. I'm affiliated with Thought Spiral, Andy's podcast.
So, oh, welcome.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, thank you. Thank you. I'm like the, I would say, the Ronald Reagan of that show. So.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah. Anyways,
do you have a deficiency in your understanding of apples or like one of those, like that type of hook?
Yeah, apples, correct.
Okay.
Exactly like that. All right. No, I wanted to talk about a couple of things. Michael's not around. I would like to yell at Michael. I like to typically yell at Michael, I don't know, every 3 months, every time he makes a Castro joke that you guys all cringe at.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But he's not around, though. Okay. So, I wanted to talk about the Florida felon voting restoration.
Okay.
Have you guys covered that at all? Because I listen to the show a lot.
I don't know what the latest is on that, frankly.
Okay. Okay, good. So, perfect. I've been keeping track of it, and some of my friends, I'm in Miami-Dade, so we have, on a local level, there's the initially rejected they were kind of rebelling against the initial ruling. So they weren't enforcing it at all. So people were able to get their rights. So, if they just went ahead and submitted, they still get a voting card. So it looks like they're not enforcing it. But recently there was a ruling, I don't know, I want to say 3 weeks ago, by a federal judge that put a temporary stay, on that poll tax. So my friend who went to prison for selling marijuana. He was able to get his voter card and not have an issue. He was able to vote in the local Miami Beach elections. So if you're out there, if you're in Florida and you're wondering, can you get it restored? Just do it.
Oh, great.
Because it looks like they cannot enforce it.
That's great. I'm really glad.
Particularly in counties like, Broward County or, Miami-Dade County, places that have large, blue contingencies, it seems like on the local level, they're not going to enforce it. But then, maybe you can look into it more, Sam, because you're more legalese than me.
We'll do that.
That's the news. I'd like to call in more. I have views. I appreciate the caller from before talking about Colombia because, I'm part of Cuban heritage, part Jewish heritage, various other heritages.
A Juban, as I recall that they were called.
Yes, correct, Juban. I'm part Juban. When Michael
no,
makes
you're
those
all
jokes,
Juban. Right, you're part Cuban, part Jew, Juban.
Yes, correct. So when Michael makes those, the reason I'm kind of get upset at Michael is because when he makes those Castro jokes, there's a big split in Miami similar to, I would say, Israelis generationally, where,
yep.
you have the generations that have experienced, the crimes of Castro and the generations that experienced the crimes of the Holocaust. But the younger generation, particularly the younger Cuban Americans, we are for leftist policies and we are trying to kind of, on a local level, rejuvenate leftist policies without the whole specter of Castro. So, I have berated Michael many times and it comes from an emotional place because I feel like he's undermining, some of what we're trying to do here. And I make it, my joke with him is, look, if he keeps it up, I'm going to take the CIA up on their offer to, train conservative comedians off the coast of Cuba.
I can give you even a more effective threat. Say that you will withhold Patreon subscriptions.
Oh, no, I unsubscribed his Patreon. I unsubscribed his Patreon, unfortunately. I'm sorry.
Well,
what jokes does he make? I really am not familiar with this.
Oh, he has a streak, and it's been for a couple of years. One time he tried to promote his Patreon, saying, "Whoa, we went from village to village." Like, that's like me saying, "Oh, I'm having a sale. Get it like it's the night before Kristallnacht." Like, come on, dude. Like, that's not how you promote your thing, especially, you know, when we're trying. Like I said, people on the ground, you know, are trying to make a difference. So I took umbrage with that.
Well, with all due respect, I do not think the Cuban Revolution is analogous to the Holocaust. And
of course not. But that's not the Holocaust.
Certainly have. That's left critiques of the Cuban government and of Castro. But I also think we need to have some like critical support for actually existing socialism in the world and like be honest about the good things and the bad things.
Sure. But the way he does it, deploys it, is not a, you know, the way he's done it is not a very thoughtful way. And that's the difference. You know what I'm saying?
Well, I would also unsubscribe from Jamie's Patreon and encourage others to unsubscribe from Michael's.
Sam, you are very like you. I notice you're very careful about this stuff. You are very.
I think my perspective on Cuba changed after, you know, having been down there for 3-4 weeks, maybe and particularly because I was able to compare this country's reaction to 9/11. It was shortly after there that I was down there. And so, you know, and at one point we were being followed by the counter-revolutionary guard or the whatever they call the it was a little bit hairy, but then you also you saw the deprivation and the difficulty that they had in the wake of the collapse of the Soviet Union, but there were also things that, you know, obviously in Cuba that are from as a function of socialism are positives. I mean, so yeah.
Right.
And I mean,
I of course I acknowledge that. And you know, that needs to be acknowledged too, but you know, there's a balance, and I think you struck that balance well. I mean, I'm just being honest. So,
I appreciate that.
You know,
happy Thanksgiving.
And that's why, you know, happy Thanksgiving, Sam. Thank you.
All right,
if you're looking for Michael to stop making problematic jokes, you might be barking up the wrong tree.
Yeah, we're not exactly aiming TMBS towards, refugees from Cuba, frankly. But I take his point. I mean, we changed a segment from the Gulag for similar sensitivity concerns.
Oh, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
The Gulag is done?
Yep, it's bad now. It's just Trump saying very bad.
The Gulag is canceled.
Yeah. Oh.
It's just a negative, negative. Segment.
It is a little bit. Yeah.
Bit glib.
I mean,
a little bit glib.
The only reason why people on the left can even joke about gulags and stuff is because we are so far from power that that's not a threat and not a conversation. So that's what's depressing to me about that.
How many Patreons did it take for him to change that?
I can't say why we changed it. Actually, I don't want to say.
Oh, it was a heavy hitter Patreon. I mean, you don't have
it
to
wasn't
say anymore.
A Patreon. Actually, we had people can go back. It's on record. We had a discussion with Matt Taibbi about it.
Oh, I see. Taibbi's, okay,
gave a little bit more of a, you know, the gulags were bad thing, and
yeah,
felt a bit weird after that.
Calling from a 407 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. This is Josh from San Antonio.
Josh from San Antonio. That is a real crossover call. Yeah.
A composite character.
What's going on, indeed. Josh from San Antonio? If that's really your name.
I wanted to talk about wealth and why it's kind of so much more of a problem than income inequality. So I ran some numbers on like what it would take to build some wealth. Does that sound interesting?
Sure, go. Yeah.
Okay, so if you're, say, a six-figure, your household is a six-figure, and you're able to do like $30,000 a year, and you decide, well, I don't want to invest that. I just want to save every year. So we're not getting into the wealth game. We're not having wealth build wealth. It could take a very, very long time for you to get to $1 billion. In fact, it could take about 30,000 years. So there's
30,000 years. I'm just trying to think where that would put me in. Okay, go ahead.
So if you're in the top 1% or so, and you're able to save like 300,000, then yeah, it wouldn't take 30,000 years. It'd take about 3,000 years. These are very rough, but
3,000 years.
Okay. I did account a little bit for taxes and stuff like that, but it's inconceivable that anybody could accumulate that kind of wealth just working, right? If we were to think of your income
right.
as your way of saving up. And so we're not even talking about Bill Gates numbers, which are like 100 billion, you know, and that would be like 300,000 years.
Right. And who's got that kind of time?
Years ago. Yeah, it's according to like the fossil record was the first time humans started showing up in Africa.
The point you're making,
that's what Bill Gates did,
is that you cannot accumulate this kind of wealth based upon your labor. Right? Yeah. I mean, that's basically
even if you're in the 1%, even if you're in the top, you know, top of the cream of the crop, you're not, it's unbelievable that you could accumulate $100 billion by your own work.
I have found it really, really difficult.
Yeah, you can only get it from exploitation, pretty much.
So, but the point that you're making is, I mean, what's the next point that you're making?
Sorry, you broke up there.
What's the next point that you're making?
Well, it's just that people tend to think of their worth in terms of their income, like that. Ooh, you're such a high income earner. You're so valuable. You're a celebrity, an athlete, or whatever. And even if you started from scratch, like say you're saving $30 million a year, it would take you 31 years, or kind of your productive work life, to get to $1 billion, and then 3,000 years to get to $100 billion. So it's like even the people that we think in society as these, like, they've added so much to society through, and we pay them so much for what they do. It's not like we got to stop thinking that we can be those people and be Bill Gates, right? There's not
right.
like,
right, right, right. No, that's a good point.
I appreciate the comment. When your money is making money for you, that's passive income. You didn't work for that. When your workers are making money for you, you're not doing shit. Sorry.
Appreciate the call.
Right.
Have a good Thanksgiving. Call from a 678 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Ian calling from Atlanta.
Ian from Atlanta. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk about Obama.
Okay.
And some of the comments that he made recently, specifically the ones he made about Twitter and posting on Twitter and how that's not real activism. I was wondering if you guys feel like the left should have pushed back kind of harder on him when he made those comments, considering like when we were doing real activism, Occupy Wall Street and stuff,
yeah.
Didn't say anything when they sent in cops to bust people's heads and arrest them, or Standing Rock when people were getting their arms blown off. He didn't say anything about that either.
Well,
so do you feel like the left should have pushed back?
I mean,
at that point, because I feel like he's trying to give us a death by a thousand cuts.
Well, I think you know, supposedly he was misquoted or whatever. But I think broadly speaking, it is important for people to understand the failures of Obama. And not just in that area. I mean, you talk about Standing Rock, you talk about Occupy, but you could also talk about Wisconsin, which was, you know, far less. It seems to me that it would be far more reasonable for him to show up in Wisconsin which was a, you know, a full-on Republican assault on union rights, which he said that he would literally put on his soft walking shoes and walk. I mean, I think it's really important for people to try and make sure that the perspective on Obama is more in line with really what he did during his administration. But, you know, on the other hand, I also think that, like, I'm not sure the utility of it is worth the effort. I mean, look, if it's more effective for me here to say Obama in that New York Times piece came out and said Medicare for all, that's a winner. And I was to reach people who were Obama fans and they'd be like, if Obama says it, I'm going to buy it. If that's more effective in my mind, then, you know, like I just...
Would you rather be seen pushing like Medicare for all Bernie or Sanders. Attacking Obama?
Yeah, I just think that, like, the sad reality is, and I have criticized Democrats for this, and, you know, putting aside, you know, motives and incentive structures and whatnot, you know, too many times they bring a knife to a gunfight, and, you know, there's multiple different ways to interpret that, but it's like, look, fight a communication war. And,
right.
And
I feel like Bernie Sanders' whole movement is based on a grassroots movement. It's based on the people getting out there and spreading the word, because it's not going to be spread on corporate media.
Yeah.
And Barack Obama is basically coming out and saying, hey, you guys, you know, that place where you can go, you can share your own opinions. I don't like that. Shut up.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. I think it's true.
Let our corporate commentators control the narrative. You guys be quiet. And meanwhile, I'm going to go here to Flint, Michigan and drink the water so that everyone thinks that it's safe and we don't talk about that anymore and do all these things to stop real activism, as he says.
Yeah.
Real activism.
Yeah, I know. I agree. And I think, you know, but the best way to push back on that is just to get out there and do more activism. And then talk about it on Twitter.
All right.
Appreciate the call, man.
All right. Thank you.
Bye. Let's go back to the IAMs. Glasses Gull. One minor point I picked up from the hearings is just how big a proportion of our dip. Oh, yeah. Okay. We got that. Michael Brooks truancy problem. I now support Kamala Harris because of Michael's behavior. Jay Tingle, the crimes of Castro, the crimes of Castro. Has Castro violated law more than any other leader? You were followed by Cuban police because you were American and you were filming. The last time I smoked pot was in Havana in 2000. It did not seem like a police state. People are poor in Cuba, but the elite are not living in luxury. A good rule of thumb would be to take Gusano criticism of Cuba and compare those with Haiti, a Caribbean capitalist paradise. Look, there was a considerable amount of political prisoners in Cuba. I think, like, you know, I don't know what specifically the crimes that that guy was talking about, but it was an oppressive regime. Is Haiti any better? I don't know, but I can tell you that there was an active sort of like governmental policy, at least stated, to immiserate the people in Cuba.
Well, to be fair, we've also seen what happens to socialists in Latin America when they err on the side of caution when it comes to, you know, taking control of the state apparatus.
I agree. I mean, but I think, like, you know, there was a period where I think in this country, the left would simply knee jerk celebrate Castro without sort of acknowledging some of the shortcomings.
Sure.
And
I agree with that.
I think
spoken to people like that.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's a little bit glib, but on balance, I think you'd rather not have money in Cuba than not have money in this society.
Oh yeah. It's much better to be poor there.
Christo, anyone catch Sanders' appearance on The Tonight Show last night? Probably the first time I've watched the show since Fallon became host, but Bernie seemed to be sincerely and very warmly welcomed, as well as shooting some hoops. He also made up his most cogent explanation of Medicare for All rollout. Worth looking up. I will check that out. The Jamie Fan Club. Can we stop making excuses for the willful ignorance of the American people? The no time excuse to have basic knowledge is BS. You don't have time to read as much as you do to know what gravity is.
I really disagree with this sort of thinking. I mean, I think like the powers that be know exactly what they're doing when they like say make things like health insurance take a lot of time or make you work 40 hours a week. Like, I think a big problem with the like dropping down a 3-day work week, for instance, would be how much time people have to look around them and realize right. how effed up our society is.
Right.
Yeah. And it's not just time either. It's energy. It's education. It's culture. It's like not seeing a lot of material results from electoral politics in your own life. And all of these powerful factors are working to uphold the status quo. I don't think we can blame it on individuals. That's so neoliberal.
It's anti-democratic.
But I will. But in my book, Blame It on the Electorate, I do speak to this. Pajama Boy, when it comes to his Patreon, Michael is a capitalist to his bones. Wink, wink.
Michael has lines prepared for that line of attack, so try him.
Oh, he does?
Yeah.
What does he say?
I've heard a number. Well, he's... he's a Marxist, so he takes capitalism seriously. Which is fair enough.
Yeah. That.
No comment.
It scans.
It works, yes. But it's not just a question of taking it seriously. It's a question of practicing it seriously, right?
Some of us live our principles.
Bullprog. Did you hear about the launch of Jordan Peterson and Dave Rubin's ThinkSpot platform where you have to pay for each post you make? I predict a major success. Not.
I got invited to that.
You did?
Yeah, but I have my own username on Discord, so I didn't think my cover would last long enough. So I might circle around back to that with a fake.
You got invited on Discord?
Somebody discorded me. I don't know what the terminology is, but said, hey, would you like an invite to this ThinkSpot? And I didn't know what it was, but now I do.
Shoot. How do I get in on that? I might be a member, for all I know, of the Dave Rubin podcast, so... As of yesterday, have successfully turned my mom, dad, grandparents, sister, brother-in-law from Biden supporters to Bernie supporters. It didn't take long, folks.
Wow.
Dave and the Berks. Is that who it is?
Yes, Dave in the Berkshires.
Dave in the Berkshires. That's what I thought. What's up, Dave?
How did you know it was me before I...
413.
Okay. Anyway, well, now you got me off track here. I did catch a little bit of that Trump rally. Oh, my God. PBS was streaming it. I couldn't understand why, but I knew you would talk about the war on Thanksgiving today.
Yes,
but
well,
that's not why I'm calling.
Okay.
So Epstein. Did you guys catch the? You probably didn't, but the Senate had a hearing on the Epstein death, and I caught a clip of from C-SPAN on it.
Yeah.
And the Republicans were really grilling this acting head of the Bureau of Prisons, and I don't know, the clip was titled Senators Ask About Jeffrey Epstein's Death, and this combined with Fox being the only media which seems to be keeping the current coverage makes me think that the right wing is going to roll out a Vince Foster 2.0 for the 2020 election.
I mean, I don't know how they can do that. It was in custody of you know, theoretically, Bill Barr is in charge of overseeing all of that. But I do think that it serves them to make a story out of Epstein at a time when the president of the United States is about to be impeached. That's what I think is going on there. I think it's just look at this shiny object, which is not to say that it doesn't deserve scrutiny. But I think what we need is like a really well-reported piece as opposed to sort of like, I don't know, garbage. But I appreciate the call.
The right won't seriously treat it. Crowder did a stunt recently where he was...
I know.
Like, can I hang myself with using Epstein thing? And he concluded that maybe Epstein could. So I would say it's controlled opposition. And if you want to, the real skinny on the Epstein stuff, it's on the left, not the right.
And so Crowder did not succeed.
He did not. He's still alive. But he said maybe Epstein could have.
Just another failure that Crowder has. I think I know who this is, too. Calling from 308. Is this perhaps Kowalski?
Oh, my. You do know me.
There's a couple really of well places, Western Mass, Nebraska, you know.
I would imagine not many 308s call you, but hey, the reason I'm calling, quite simple, just wanted to give your viewers here a couple talking points for Thanksgiving on Medicare for All that's working in the heartland, or AKA real America, if you have to talk to those kind of relatives. So, basically, treat Medicare for All or, single payer as just call it a common good. That's, capitalist wording, and I mean, in all actuality, it does work. Point out the fact that you just want capitalism to work at the local level because, the hospitals then can actually compete with one another. It's free at the point of service. In many ways, it works just like our road systems. It's free at the point of use. Yes, we all pay for it, but we all benefit from it. It actually does work a little bit better than you'd think, wording it like that.
That sounds pretty good. Free at the point of service is like our roads. It's a common good. We pay into it, and it allows capitalism to flourish on the local level.
I mean, also, like, just speaking of roads, as I'm sitting here driving after we got probably 6 inches of snow last night, the roads are all cleared. They've got salt on them. People are commuting. Now, that doesn't really sound like a failure of the local government, and for the most part, the local government, they just simply contract local people to go out and do this. So, there's absolutely no reason why something like that cannot work on the national level for healthcare. Roads are a success. We get from A to B.
Right. And, the roads are free, but not really, and that's not such a bad dynamic.
Because it is a common good, which is a fundamental foundation to capitalism. Not saying it isn't also part of socialism or communism, but, it's...
You can leave that part out.
That's not the audience. Well, it's just not the audience you need to be talking to.
Right. No. Good idea.
Also, point out that socialism is just basically democratized economics. That's it.
Yep.
That will only work if the, people you're talking to are not literally of the capitalist class. But most people aren't.
Just always bring things back to we need to help workers. We're all workers. Like, there are workers in California. There are workers here. Our interests align. And particularly for people in low-income or rural areas, things like Medicare for All disproportionately benefits us because it'll bring more money and resources into our communities. That means more jobs, more people spending money, more kids in the local schools. Like, it's just good all around.
Great. What else you got? One more?
Well, I guess I hope you guys all have a good Trumpsgiving. That and I will get in contact with you soon. My campaign should go up here pretty soon. I just need to make sure I've got all of this wording 100% right. Otherwise, the opposition's going to kill me.
All right. Well, great. Good luck with that. Have a great Thanksgiving. Thank you, Kowalski.
Peace, everyone.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Those are good talking points for Thanksgiving. Call them from a 559 area code. I have no idea.
Hey. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah. Who's this?
Hi, this is Joe
from California.
Joe from California, what's on your mind?
Hey, I just wanted to say that I was really, really proud of my representative up there on the impeachment hearing. Of course, I'm calling from California's 22nd district, Devin Nunes' district.
Moo.
Yeah, so, I mean, I can't believe, like, how much that guy just lies up there and everything. I mean,
it's pretty nuts.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like they go there to Congress and they get their shame gland removed or something.
Well, I think it's quite possible, and I'm getting feedback. I'm going to let you go, but appreciate the call. I think it's quite possible that Devin Nunes has a little bit more investment in these hearings than your average congressman might. I suspect his involvement is a little bit deeper than your average congressman's. I have no sense of that other than what's been publicly reported, but he seems to have been extremely active for a congressman in the reelection of Donald Trump, like him sending representatives over to Ukraine, him getting involved with he seems to be intimately tied. Trying to make America great in some unnamed way. All right, look, folks, here's what we're going to do. If you are on the phone, if you've been on the phone for longer than 30 minutes or so, we're going to race through and get to you. I can't promise anything less than that. And we're going to do 60 seconds per person. All right. We're going to do this as a Thanksgiving treat. Call them from a 585 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? Well, this is not going that well. All right. Calling from a 774 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? You got about 60 seconds. Go. Hello? What's going on with our phones?
Oh, hello, hello.
Hello. Who's this? Where are you calling
from? It's Corey from Worcester.
Corey from Worcester. 774. All right.
More succinct.
Okay.
I thought it was a little odd that that Steven Crowder wanted to show off his autoerotic asphyxiation fetish on his own show, but you know, it's a shame we couldn't have traded him for John Carradine.
Yeah.
So I don't know if you know about the Pawsox Stadium that is being moved to Worcester.
Yep, I'm aware.
So I'm actually getting involved locally with a few organizations to deal with like rent control and like making sure that, you know, that the issues with the wealthy influence coming in, because there's going to be a hell of a lot of that, is going to at least less negatively impact the population, because
right,
you can only do so much, but, you know, try to pressure some of the local politicians to really side with the people and make sure that the displacement isn't too horrific when that stadium comes in. So,
oh, good.
Just wanted to throw that out.
Is there a website? Do you have a site or something where people can get involved?
There's a few organizations that I'm getting involved with. When I know more and how these are actually getting off the ground, because the first one, actually, the night that I was going to, they had their power shut off, so that wasn't a very.
All right. Well,
I was a little foreboding.
Corey, call back in. I'm interested in hearing more about that.
Absolutely.
All right. Thanks, man.
Happy Thanksgiving, guys.
Happy Thanksgiving. From Worcester, 774. Where's that from? Calling from a 260 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? You got a minute. Who's this?
Hey, this is Jake from Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Jake from Fort Wayne, Indiana. What's on your mind, Jake?
So I just have a quick anecdote and then some advice for Bernie supporters. So a couple weeks ago, Bernie was in Minnesota and he did a rally with Ilhan Omar. And I thought it was pretty great. I was watching it on TV. I was drinking. The Packers had just lost. I drank way too much. And then I tried to donate $10 to the Bernie campaign. Well, I accidentally donated $100 to the Bernie campaign. I thought, if we were all just drinking more, then Bernie would have so much money, he wouldn't know what to do with. So I think everybody needs to watch as many of these rallies as they can on YouTube or wherever it is, and just have a glass of whatever your favorite thing is, and then bring about the revolution. Let's do this thing. Lula Libre. Bye, bye, Bowie. Love you. Bye.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving. Good call. Well done. Came in at 50 seconds. Calling from a 978 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
From Mass. What's going on?
Who's this?
Matt from Mass.
Matt from Mass. You got 60 seconds. Go.
All right. I just wanted to say two techniques for arguing with people at your Thanksgiving. If it's a conservative and they talk about Obama and how Obama was bad, tell them you also hate Obama, and that'll throw them off their game.
Yeah.
And then if you're talking to a liberal and they talk about how, you know, things just work this way and, you know, change is impossible, tell them that runs against about like 5,000 years of human history. So just like two talk points real quick. So
good job, Matt. Have a good Thanksgiving. Thanks for the call.
You too. Bye.
These are good calls. Calling from a 215 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, Sam. It's Mindy. How are you?
Mindy, you get 90 seconds.
What? I get how many?
90.
Sam, how do we deal with the fact that Main Street media won't deal with Bernie or Elizabeth Warren at all, and every guest they have on is completely shutting down the idea of them and just making them out like they're devils?
Well, promote, obviously, the Majority Report. That's the first thing. The second thing, and probably more relevant, is make phone calls. Tell your friends, organize, right? I mean,
because every time I talk to my friends about it that are all my age, I feel like I'm the middle age pulse of the show sometimes. But we'll go out to dinner with people and they're like, oh, yeah, we love Biden and we love this, you know, like, and they're just like, they're all up in Bloomberg and all that shit. And I just, they're just not getting it, like, because this is all they're listening to and this is all they know.
I would just say, you know, I would make the electability case. I mean, it seems to me the easiest case in the world is for people to say, look at Biden. I mean, seriously, do you think Biden is going to make it?
Yeah. And then they go like, you know, Pete's the Wonder Boy. You know, he's like the Rhodes Scholar. And I'm like, well, Cory Booker's a Rhodes Scholar. Nobody's talking about him being a Rhodes Scholar. It's just like I feel like I'm having arguments with my people.
Well, you know, start with Biden and then you just work your way down.
Okay, so that's it.
I mean, there's nothing else to do. And ultimately, you just got to organize for Bernie. I mean, that's it.
Turnout is more important than persuasion.
Well, that's where I'm at. So people are kind of like not wanting to talk to me about politics anymore because I'm kind of like...
I understand. Maybe phone bank then. Talk to people who don't know you.
I think that's something we have in common, Mindy.
Oh, what? They don't want to talk to you either? Like you're like the the bad person?
I am the... I would say more annoying than bad. Like my friends are really sick of hearing about, you know, leftist politics from me. But you know what? All good organizers are at least a little bit annoying. So there you go.
Mindy, have a happy Thanksgiving.
Did I get under my 90?
Well, you got closer about 2 minutes, frankly.
Oh, great. Thank you. Love you guys.
Love
happy
you.
Thanksgiving.
Bye.
I'm not dead. I'm just not saying it. I mean, I'm just not on that much anymore. I'm not calling in. Just listening.
Well, I appreciate you calling in now. Happy Thanksgiving. We miss you. Calling from a 732 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is Nate from New Jersey.
Nate, what's on your mind?
I'm just wanting to say happy birthday to me. Also, I called in about a month ago about Turkey invading Syria, and that, you know, Turkey's whole rationale for why, oh, it's okay, is because they're attacking us. If they really wanted to pull this kind of nonsense, they should have done it through NATO. All they're doing right now is just fomenting more war and more terrorist attacks.
Yeah, I think you're right about that. Appreciate the call, Nate. Happy birthday and happy Thanksgiving.
Thanks, Sam. Have a good one.
You too. Calling from a 720 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. This is Joe from Colorado.
Joe from Colorado.
Just about the IDW real quick and progressive media. And I think that I'm really surprised that manufacturing content is so powerful than I thought it would be at this point with the internet. And I wish that the IDW and progressive media like yourselves and everybody else who supports Bernie would be able to team up in a way. And I think one way would be to try and reach out to somebody like Eric Weinstein and Brett Weinstein a little bit more. He said in that one clip that he's only listened to you talk for about 45 minutes. And I suppose that he probably only listened to your Dave Rubin clips. And so he had the perspective.
I talked to Eric on the phone personally for an hour. And that dude still let Sam Harris call me a psychopath on his show. So I don't know. Do I need to send him a muffin basket? What do I need to do? Like
I was hoping that you would just maybe listen to his first appearance. I think it was number 41 on Sam Harris's show, where he actually, I think he's more open to the left than he makes out sometimes. Like,
well, he might be, but listen, but he might be, but so what? I mean, honestly.
Well, I don't know. I think he's got some really interesting points of view, and if he was able to get over whatever his problem is, that he would be a really interesting guest. You know,
let me ask you this. Really, let me ask you this, Joe. Joe.
Okay, go ahead.
Let me ask you this. You get off the phone right now. I say, Joe came on here and he's throwing around. He's like, what a psychopathic like way to approach this that Joe had. Joe, you tell me. This is the first thought that occurred to you. Like, hey, I can actually build some bridges with Sam.
Yeah, I mean, I understand.
Right. Well, listen, I'll give it some thought. Because it's Thanksgiving, and I'm going to be in the Thanksgiving spirit.
Yeah.
And thank you for calling, Joe.
Folks, the IDW is a hierarchy maintenance project.
Yeah. There you go.
I don't know how many of those folks are going to go for socialism.
Especially the ones that work for Peter Thiel.
Yes, indeed. Calling from a 910 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is Brandon from Wisconsin.
Brandon from Wisconsin. What's on your mind?
I just wanted to let you guys know that I started a YouTube channel called I Am a Revolutionary. It's basically a channel that will focus on civil rights history. And I just wanted to make it because I know there's not a lot of content like that on YouTube.
Interesting. What's it called?
I Am a Revolutionary. It's a quote from Fred Hampton.
I Am a Revolutionary. Is it launched?
It's launched. Like, I only have one video, but it's an introduction video. Like, over this Thanksgiving weekend, I'll be recording some stuff.
Great. We'll check it out. Thanks, Matt.
Sounds like our
have
show.
A happy Thanksgiving. All right. Calling from a 724 area code.
Yeah. Hello, Sam. This is Kevin calling from Pittsburgh. How are you?
Kevin from Pittsburgh. How are you doing? You got 60 seconds. Go.
I'm going fast. So I was originally going to call you about Dennis Miller since I'm from Pittsburgh, but I'll save that for another call.
Please.
I've been watching your show for a long time. I've recently started showing the show to my girlfriend, dipping her toes in, and sometimes we're sitting around watching streaming shows. What I'll do is, as a palate cleanser, we'll sit there and watch Sam Debates Libertarians.
Good.
Which has been extremely entertaining and edifying. And she absolutely loves you. She thinks you're adorable.
Could you
do me a favor?
Sure.
To get me in good with the holidays and look at the camera and say, hello, Ashley. Thank you for watching.
Hello, Ashley. Thank you for watching.
You're the best, Sam. Happy holidays. And, fuck Mike Cernovich 700,000 times, give or take.
Appreciate that very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Well, Ashley has very good taste. I appreciate calling from a 916 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
I think you might be talking to me, right?
Yeah.
I'm making sure.
Yep. You got 60 seconds.
Okay, hi. I'm Aaron from Sacramento.
Aaron from Sacramento.
Pluto Alan Gallo's on YouTube, but starting up a horror channel, which should be launching after the first. But I'm calling about a couple of points. One of the first points I wanted to make, as a gay person, I'm kind of put off by the idea of being patronized. You know, I kind of feel patronized by Buttigieg being put up in the media. It kind of feels to me kind of like, oh, he's your token gay and all that kind of stuff. When that shouldn't be what it's about, because that's not what it's about to me. I support Bernie and Warren because they're about the policies and they're about the people. You can be turquoise with pink polka dots, gay, straight, bi, trans. I don't really care. But if you support the people, then you get my vote. I mean, I don't like being patronized. I see it all the time in politics, and this identity politics shit on both sides, it's sickening. We got Dave Rubin on the right, and then we got Buttigieg on the left. And so they don't support the people. They support the business. That's
you know,
not cool to me.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that. And the only thing I would say is that I do think that, like, look, ultimately, and obviously your experience has been firsthand, but I do think that just, and I don't know how old you are, but I
24.
Okay, well, so you're old enough to have seen this too on some level. Like, you know, just the implications of like, you know, Will and Grace, right? Or you know, shows like, or, you know, Ellen coming out. It really, I think, has made a material difference in the lives, particularly of young people. But when it comes to the presidency, I agree with you. I think it's, you know, all well and good that he shows that gay people, you know, should be considered for every position in life, and it normalizes it. I mean, it's sort of ridiculous to say this in New York, it sort of feels like, but in parts of the country still, it's a real issue. But I agree with you. It's not sufficient.
Something about what you just said.
Yeah.
Can I interject real quick? I'm actually right now currently displaced. The reason why I haven't started my channel is I'm currently displaced because of A, my sexuality, and B, my disability. And I'm in Sacramento, California, of all places.
Right.
So
okay.
I'm right there with you. I understand what you're saying.
But I also agree with you that, like, it is not sufficient. That should not be the primary selling point of your the exclusive selling point of your candidacy. I appreciate the call.
Yeah. Have a happy Thanksgiving. Love you guys.
You too. Bye bye. Calling from a 347 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is me?
Yep. Got 60 seconds. Go.
Hey. Okay. This is Anthony from New York City. Are you familiar with the Byron Allen versus Comcast case going on in the Supreme Court right now?
No.
So it's a $20 billion lawsuit that Byron Allen brought up. He is the owner of the Weather Channel. Basically, the lawsuit is racial bias against Comcast for not carrying on specific black-owned media. It's a distribution case. They found that Comcast, basically you have to essentially buy the more expensive packages in Comcast in order to get access to black-owned channels and networks outside of like BET. And they won in the Ninth Circuit. Comcast pushed it to go to the Supreme Court right now. And they're essentially arguing the only way that they can prove that there was discrimination is that if that was the sole reason for the refusal.
So in other words, like de jure as opposed to de facto, I think is the argument.
I think of the but-for clause.
Okay.
Or something like that.
All right. Interesting.
If they win this in the Supreme Court, it'll possibly overturn the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which allows for basically anti-discrimination against minorities to contract. So I think it's a big case that definitely needs more coverage.
All right. We'll keep an eye out for it. I appreciate the call. Have a good Thanksgiving. Calling from a 516 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Is this me?
Yep.
This is Whitey from Long Island.
What's Whitey up? From Long Island. You got 60 seconds. Go.
So on Jimmy Dore's show, he was saying that Tulsi Gabbard is better on foreign policy than Bernie Sanders. And that shit's just a straight up lie, if you ask me.
I guess it depends on how you assess it. She's a big supporter, as far as I can tell, of the war on terror, which I think is, you know, sort of fundamentally the you know, our modern imperialist, primary modern
exactly.
imperialist
she's,
too.
She's an anti-interventionist, and in the sense that she
say,
doesn't
just
think
from like
a drone is an intervention.
Global solidarity standpoint, she's not even like as good as Bernie Sanders. But yeah, even on this fucking war of terror, she's not as good either.
Well,
but she was on Jimmy Dore's show, so
she did go on Jimmy Dore's show. So that really also has a huge bearing on your foreign policy assessment. Appreciate the call.
Yeah. All right.
As you know, Bernie Sanders really, his policies got really much worse when he did not go on Jimmy Dore's show. Calling from a 972 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello?
Hello? We only have three more callers.
Is this me?
It is you. You got 55 seconds now. Who is it? Where are you calling from?
Oh, shoot. I'm from Israel. Would rather not disclose my name. I'm about to enlist. So, is that okay?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so what I want to talk about. All right, so this is a bit late, but I wanted to call a few weeks before. Didn't get to it. Back when the Zuckerberg hearing were being played out, coincidentally, in Israel, there was a pretty large liberalization of the online banking sort of services. And surprisingly, suddenly, LibraCoin started a very large marketing push on various media networks. Basically, a lot of very nice, very PC ads about how much we appreciate our customers and how much we are thankful and all the hard work we've done and how we just want to provide services for the for all the people. And
interesting.
Yeah, I think it's just very telling that, like, as soon as those hearings were happening and as soon as more market opportunities were being offered in that place, they immediately jumped on that and, like, are trying to get into that market and basically take over it.
I appreciate the call.
Can I add one more thing?
Yeah, quick.
Do I have time? I wanted to respond to a thing that was said before about electability, and I think it's very much worth mentioning that basically the whole, like, Biden usually bringing up the idea of electability for why we should vote for him. But the thing that him and the Obama coalition, I guess you could call it, don't mention is that they didn't just lose the 2016 election. They lost three elections, three and a half, technically. They lost in 2010, they lost in 2014, and they also lost in seat in 2012 as well. So their argument has been proven wrong, not just once, but various times. And it's worth mentioning that in 2013, there are, like, recordings of Bernie Sanders standing outside the White House while Joe Biden and Barack Obama are inside, attempting to cut Social Security to win over supposed moderate Republican support.
I agree. So, like, appreciate
that. Very good argument.
Yeah, good. I appreciate it. Good, good point. I think some of that you can find in Ryan Grimm's book, too. Calling from a 703 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
This is Marcus Sam. How you doing, brother?
Good. How you doing? You got 60 seconds.
I wanted to see what life was like at an echo chamber, so I joined a Trump-supporting group. I started off slowly, a little bit of memes here and there. Then I kicked it up a notch, started posting Mein Kampf quotes. Exchange the word Jew for Democrat. You'd be surprised how much these people love those quotes.
Oh my
God. Just a warning. Keep an eye out on them.
All right. I appreciate the call.
Take screenshots of your work, please.
Yes, I would take screenshots. That would be very helpful, I think. Appreciate the call. I picked up quite a bit of that vibe on the Tim Pool comments on our debating, to be honest with you. All right. We only have two more calls left. Calling from a 516 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hello, am I on? It's Maya.
Maya, you are the second to last caller before Thanksgiving.
Oh, my God, yay.
You got 60
okay,
seconds.
So I had a protest on the 25th against Seth Meyers in New York City. Yeah, so he's being an asshole. Him and his wife have been, like, annoying for years now. They have, like, a vendetta against sex workers that I don't comprehend where it comes from.
Seth Meyers?
But,
yeah, this is a real thing.
What? Okay.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking of, today I'm going to a Thanksgiving dinner with my sex worker colleagues, and we're going to be planning a protest, outside his show, basically, because it's getting bad. So he hosted an event because they're going to be introducing a bill that's going to criminalize sex workers. Obviously, it's going to be the Nordic model. So he hosted the event at WeWork in New York City, which I just love the location they picked for this. His wife is Alexei Ashy Myers. I'm bad at pronouncing names, but she's a prosecutor. and she's like trying to rebrand herself as like a human rights lawyer and an abolitionist. But yeah, she put people in prison for many years in Brooklyn, and then just married Myers, moved to New York City. They have a $7.5 million house. She works for Sanctuary for Families, which, funny story, the price of their house is literally the amount of funding that Sanctuary for Families has. And most of that money does not go to people. It doesn't even go to survivors or anything.
All right. Well, I'm going to look into it, because I have not followed Seth Meyers' anti-sex worker expert.
No, it's a huge business, and they get celebrities on board to oppose decriminalization under the banner of fighting sex trafficking in a way that flies in the face of all the available evidence and all of the things that current sex workers are telling us that we need to do in order to protect their human rights as workers and as people.
By the way, like, Seth Meyers get involved in this? Oh, I guess because of his wife. I don't know. It seems bizarre. All right. The final call of the day, folks. If it's not you, I'm sorry. You didn't make it under the thing. I gave you fair warning about what we were going to be doing in terms of the callers. You're calling from a 206 area code.
No way.
Yes. Who's this?
Fantastic. Well, first time, long time. Sammy, I love you guys. I'm calling from the Hudson Valley, just north of you.
Oh, all right.
And I wanted to give a shout out to all of you guys, the work you do. I think it's fantastic. I mean, if I believed in God, I would tell you you're doing God's work.
Oh, well, thank you. That's very sweet, I think.
And, you know, so, Matt, I have a quick question from Matt.
Gotta hurry.
He's from North Dakota.
Quick.
I'm here.
I really want to point you guys to a Guardian piece about South Dakota and the trust laws. The great American tax haven, why the super rich left South Dakota.
Oh, yeah,
Matt,
we did
being
that
from
book.
North Dakota, I believe that he's probably aware of this. Definitely something to put on your radar.
We have that book, actually. Shaxton. Financial Curse. Yes. Did we interview him?
A very recent piece on November 14th by Oliver Bullo in The Guardian. Unbelievable read. Like, being from South Dakota, that's where I grew up. I'm amazed that this is happening.
All right, well, dude,
but
listen.
It really does deserve some attention.
We'll look at that piece, but also go back and listen to my interview with Neil Shaxton. Nicholas Shaxton, which was like a week ago, on the financial curse.
Okay.
He talks about that. We talk about that, about how that's.
I mean, it's basically like they're putting, you know, this is like, I mean, forget about offshore.
Exactly. Go back and listen to that interview. Don't miss an interview on the show.
I'm going to.
Do not miss an interview on this show. You cannot.
I am. I'm absolutely going to.
Appreciate the call. Have a good Thanksgiving.
Okay.
Folks, that is all the time we have. I wish you all a Thanksgiving. I want to take this opportunity, though somebody stepped on it a little bit, to thank Brendan and Jamie and Matt, and even Michael to a certain extent. And David, thank you. You guys are great. Thank you, audience. Really appreciate it. Talk to you in a couple of days. Bye-bye. It might take strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive between the 101.